Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We've been following since last night. Clemson students and staff are meeting right now to talk about an African-American history banner on campus that's been defaced. 7 News reporter Addie Hampton, you see her standing by live. That's the Hendricks Student Center behind her there. So tell us about that meeting, Addie.
Well, Gordon, that meeting starting just behind me. In fact, students still pouring in here. Today, I actually spoke to University President Jim Clements. He calls this whole incident unfortunate, especially considering that the banner was promoting African-American history as well as a groundbreaking of historical markers that actually mark a spot where slaves once lived and worked here on Clemson's campus. Now, as for race relations, President Clements says we have a long way to go here on campus, but today was actually a huge step forward.
This is a process. This is a big step in the process. So for us to mark officially part of our history, that can be uncomfortable. It's really important.
Says Clemson University President Dr. Jim Clements.
1, 2, 3, go Tigers!
With orange shovels in hand, he joined trustees and faculty in breaking ground on a monument marking the spot where enslaved African Americans lived and worked at Fort Hill.
The markers are going up, and this is significant.
It's a banner marking this event that was defaced just a day before. A bunch of bananas hanging off the banner, sparking Clements and the school to respond about race relations on campus.
We absolutely have a ways to go, and yesterday was hurtful and unfortunate in so many ways, but at least those who were involved turned themselves in today, which is a good sign.
The topic of race relations here isn't new. Efforts to rename Tillman Hall, named after Clemson founder and declared white supremacist Benjamin Tillman, failed last year, but not before a task force set out to fill in the blanks of the school's history pages, especially in regards to minority history.
Now you have hiccups like we had yesterday, but frankly, I mean, they're just tiny blips, and we're making great progress at Clemson, and I'm really, really proud of what we've done here today.
Dr. James Bostic has led the charge to unveiling a new history, as he calls it.
All it is telling an accurate history of Clemson, and I love it.
And it's a history that 90-year-old Eva Hester Martin is glad to witness. Her great-grandparents were slaves living in that very spot being commemorated more than 150 years later.
It feels humbling in a sense. You know, I just feel really I feel grateful too that I lived long enough to come here and to see this.
Now her great grandparents Sharper and Caroline will live on, not just in her mind, but through a marker that will stand the test of Clemson's ever-changing time. Now, Mrs. Martin actually celebrated her 90th birthday today, and she said she's just glad that her great-grandfather, who was actually a Civil War soldier as well as a man of great pride, will be remembered as being more than just a slave. I'm reporting live here in Clemson, Addie Hampton, 7 News.
All right, Addie, we'll let you cover a little bit of that meeting. Thanks for that report.
Decals, context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, April 14th, 2016. So I have been told the threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. favorite quotes from my man, Ben Tillman. Folks remember the book study session from last summer. He has a fountain of colorful commentary on race and Negroes and what should be done. Former governor, former U.S. senator, co-founder of Clemson University, Winthrop University, proud, staunch white supremacist, Pitchfork Ben Tillman. Broadcast for today, we attempted to get it done on Monday. Did not happen. We were able to reschedule and make things happen today to get more information both about the banana incident from this week as well as the history of racism, white supremacy in the state of South Carolina, inclusive of Pitchfork, Ben Tillman, Dylan Storm Roof, and the white supremacist massacre at Mother Emanuel AME Church last summer, and even this week, the banana incident at Clemson University. And in fact, we've done so much talking about South Carolina over the past year, even before we got to Dylan Storm Roof with the shooting of Walter Scott in the spring of last year. We had Melvin Poole, former representative of the Rock Hill branch of the NAACP chapter in South Carolina. He was with us to discuss the Friendship Nine in February of last year. I think the day that he came on the program, there was a high school in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where some racist vandals spray painted Happy Nigger Month. This was at the beginning of February, Black History Month. They painted Happy Nigger Month on a rock that was on school property. To my knowledge, no one was ever found. No one was arrested. No suspects, anything of that nature. There just have been a myriad of incidents. The situation that happened at the Citadel at 2015, where some of the cadets dressed in Klan regalia. They had white hoods and white garb on that looked very much like Klan outfits, and that went viral. And then they had the punishments that came out right at the end of 2015. But just there have been a myriad of incidents with regards to racism, white supremacy. I even would have to include South Carolina State University, because we discussed that historically black institution last year as well, and them being underfunded in the system of racism, white supremacy might even lead to them shutting down. But it's just been a lot, and I think all of that, you can connect the dots, as Dr. Francis Cress Welsing would say, when you get an understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, and the history of how white supremacy has evolved, particularly in the state of South Carolina. Our guest for today's broadcast, he is a professor down at Clemson University, to be specific. He is Creativity Professor of Humanities, Professor of History, Sociology, and Computer Science at Clemson University, and the director of the Clemson Cyber Institute from 2008 to 2010. He was the Burroughs Distinguished Professor of Southern History and Culture at Coastal Carolina University. We'll be discussing today his Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, In My Father's House, Our Many Mansions, Family and Community in Edgefield, South Carolina, which was published in 1985. He also wrote The Age of Lincoln, came out in 2007. Wealth of information about the great state of South Carolina. Glad to have him on the program. Joining us live, our guest, Professor Vernon Burton. Professor Burton, you with us, sir?
I am, and I do want to apologize, especially to you, Gus, and any of your audience who was looking for me, I believe, on Tuesday night. That was totally my fault, and I just let things slip and messed up and forgot about it. So here I am, as apologetic as can be, and hope I didn't mess people up too badly.
We survived. We survived, and looking forward to the dialogue this evening, sir. Anything that you think would be important for listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do, before we get started?
I'm a historian. I don't know what's really important or not, but I grew up in the small town of 96, South Carolina, did my graduate work at Princeton, and really spent most of my career at the University of Illinois, where I was University Distinguished Teacher, Distinguished Scholar, Professor of History, African-American Studies, and Sociology, and always wanted to teach in the South and be back in the South. And you have to be careful what you pray for, because it happened, and then I realized I had become an Illini when I arrived here. I've done a lot of work as an expert witness for minority plaintiffs. In fact, I guess it's relevant. I was the expert witness for Mr. Woodfox in the Angola case that you might have read about not too long ago in Louisiana, who had been in solitary confinement since 1972. And when those attorneys called me, they asked We thought you were at the University of Illinois, the land of Lincoln. You're at Clemson now. Where is Clemson? I said, well, Clemson's in South Carolina. It's built on the plantation of John C. Calhoun, who is the statesman. He was also vice president of the United States, but when he was a senator, U.S. senator, he introduced the pro-slavery argument, whereas before that, people had sort of been able to live with the idea that slavery was necessary evil. He argued that it was the not an evil at all, but a positive good, good for blacks and whites and for the United States and liberty. And then, of course, Clemson was founded by Ben Tillman. He is sort of the politician who saw it through as part of what today historians would call his progressive era reforms. But, of course, his major reform was disfranchising and bringing in legal segregation. He was not only the, sort of the father of Clemson, but he was also the father of the 1895 Constitution, which is the Constitution, though amended a lot, still the basic Constitution of South Carolina. And then at that time, my office was actually in the Strom Thurmond Institute. No longer is, but of course, Strom Thurmond is a Clemson graduate, longtime serving senator, who was famous for being the 1948 Dixiecrat candidate, running as a states' rights Democrat, objecting strongly to Harry Truman's stand, early stance on civil rights and standing for segregation. So a big change from land of Lincoln to here in South Carolina. But there are positive things going on here, too. I agree with all the things you said that are going on, but I do see some very positive things happening and believe that there's a window of opportunity, that whereas in 1860, South Carolina led the nation in race, but in the wrong direction, that is, in defense of slavery, that since the terrible tragedy of Charleston and Mother Emanuel's murder of the nine people who were in a moment of worship, including the senator Clementa Pinckney, that South Carolina has an opportunity since having the flag come down. I was on NPR, I think, the week before, and they said, do you think it will come down? And I really did not think it would. But I think it was, in fact, another Southern characteristic. We all talk about race and understand the importance of race in the South, but another force that affects who Southerners are, black and white, is religion and faith. And when those families, when they confronted the alleged murderer, Dylan Roof, instead of what would have been, I think, certainly most of our reaction of outrage at him, they actually called upon grace and, like Christ on the cross, said, you know, we forgive him and pray for him. And I think it's interesting. If you go through those debates about bringing down the flag and the state legislature, the word grace resounds over and over and over again. And I believe it's that, not the murders, but how the African-American families responded that helped bring that flag down and made people listen to what had been said a long time by particularly African-Americans, some others, how they felt about the flag. So I hope that we can build upon this opportunity to maybe lead the nation in a better way on race.
That is a mouthful. Wow. I'm sure listeners will have a lot of questions, and we'll try to dissect and connect the dots with your book and a lot of the incidents contemporary that have happened, things that you touched on in your introduction. Before we even jump into that, are you a white man? Just for folks who haven't seen you, are you a white man?
I am.
Okay.
Although I will say that for many, many years, a lot of people reading my writing had assumed that I was African-American, and I once was stranded at the San Diego airport when I was an expert witness in California in the El Centro case because they thought I was black, and so they just left me there, and I had to call and get them to come back. So I take that as a something of pride, actually.
Wow. Some of our listeners, they on Tuesday, they were looking at different pictures of you that are online and what have you. And some of the folks who saw your photograph said, I wonder if Professor Burton, you know, if he has maybe a black grandparent or some non-white ancestry. They thought you had your pigmentation looked a little bit darker, I guess, than what they were suspecting. Can you speak to that? Do you have any non-white ancestors to your knowledge?
Not that I know of, but I sort of assume, being a person of faith, that we're all related. So I would assume in that way, but not of any that I know of, or that, you know, have been aware of in any way.
Right on.
I do have three grandchildren who are African American.
Fascinating. Okay. We will, before we get to the book, I try to ask all of our guests, definition for racism, I think, is extremely important anytime this subject matter is being covered. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
That's certainly a definition we can work with as a working definition. I have about a 7-page paper. If you remind me, I'll send it to you, that I have worked with students defining what I think is ways to use race and the way I've had to use it to testify in court. Of course, there's institutional racism. There's prejudice. How do you distinguish between prejudice that? And with your definition, and this is a definition that a number of people would accept, it would say, though, that racism would only work one way. And I think there's a good argument for that it has been whites, Caucasians, who have had power. Therefore, you've got to have power to, in some way, you know, do the kind of things you're saying that are done. But I can certainly work with your definition and understand it and have, you know, work with people who have used that definition. I have different ones, you know, for different occasions, particularly to use, say, when you're in the courtroom or when you're talking about the institutional racism, the difference between prejudice and racism. Whether there's an old historical debate about societal and ideological racism. It was George Frederickson who wrote a book called White Over Black years ago, and I used to, in fact, disagree with him. I thought it really didn't matter. Now, of course, as we've established, at least I think I'm white, that as a white person, I thought it was sort of silly to say that, you know, it mattered what people thought of you and argued about you intellectually versus how they treated you. But in my old age, I've come 180 degrees and think that George Frederickson's probably owned to something. And do I have a moment here to give an example of what I'm talking about?
If I just want to try to be clear, one of the things I really try to be precise about is making sure I get a specific answer. Just if you think the definition that I gave is accurate, do you think such a system exists? And then if you want to give your example, that's fine. Just want to make sure we can cover as much as we can to not get too bogged down in things. But if you could give us a clear response, that would be great.
Okay. I think that it is a definition that a lot of people would accept. I would modify it in different ways, as I've said, as a scholar, but I'm comfortable using that and understanding that's your definition and trying to work within those examples.
If you said you would make any modifications, are there any aspects of the definition that you think are inaccurate? And if so, which aspects?
I don't think that the system is such as inaccurate, but I do believe that racism can work from different groups. I believe that you can have African Americans who can be racist, that is prejudiced, and a little bit beyond prejudice toward whites. Now, do they have the system, you know, the structure to make that into something like white supremacy? I don't think so. But I would be careful if I were doing it to say that racism is a one-way street. What you've done is put social and political power, cultural power, and all those things on as part of the definition.
Hmm, that is fascinating. Has a black person, non-white person, period, ever practiced racism against you because you are white?
Not to my knowledge, and there are scholars who argue that they cannot do that because, accepting the sort of premises that you've laid out, that they don't control those cultural, intellectual, social forces that would allow them to do the kind of institutional, say, racism and things that exist.
Okay.
But there's a big difference. I mean, you have to divide out between institutional racism, personal racism, societal racism, ideological racism. So that's my only concern. But if you want to, we can just work with your definition and me stay within those parameters.
All righty. I just pointing this out for listeners, anytime that a white person at any point anywhere on the planet suggests that non-white people can practice racism against white people, that is the sort of thing that I generally flag as a major act of white supremacy. It's been my experience that white people, even generally it's been my experience, even white children, they know that a non-white person cannot practice racism against a white person. That non-white person may be upset with white people. They may call that white person names, but they do not have the power to keep that white person or groups of white people from getting a job, going to school, pulling a Ben Tillman, and making it so that white people cannot vote. I have not seen that anywhere on the planet. To my knowledge, we've had white people and non-white people on this program from across the globe. And anytime that I hear a white person even make that sort of comment, and especially the white people who have said that, that non-white people can or maybe could practice racism against white people, when I've asked, well, has a non-white person practiced racism against you? Almost in unison, all of the white people I've asked have said no. But they still are willing to at least verbalize that maybe a non-white person could practice racism against a white person. And as I said before, I think that's just, that is a major act of white supremacy and causing confusion. Before we even move forward to get to some of the things in your book, because I think your book makes this pretty clear what I'm saying. I think your book does give some pretty accurate points about what it means to be white and the system of white supremacy in total. There's a quote that I wanted to read you. This is a non-white author. And he was talking about racism, and he wrote, this was at the end of 2014. He said, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough." And I've been trying to ask as many of our white guests as possible if they think that this statement is true. And I expect, I'm really just focused on the first part of the statement. Do you think, Professor Burton, do you think that this statement is true where he says white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? You as a white person, your white family, the white people that you're around, do you think it's accurate that a sizable portion of the white people that you have met and know about throughout your time on the planet, they are sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
I can't speak for all people in that way. I know a lot of people who are, I know a lot of people who are not enough pained by it and don't understand it and would deny, in fact, what you and I agree on about racism. You know, a lot of people would just, even though I think that we're racist and that in some of their action, they would deny themselves that they are racist. So I think that's, and there's a large number of them. So I'm not sure I agree with that. I would agree with the second part, that those that are, we probably are not pained enough when you think about what it has meant, what has happened in the history of our country and continues to happen.
The white people that you know, that you assert are pained sincerely and greatly pained by racism, how do they demonstrate? What do they do specifically to demonstrate that they are sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
Well, many will try to support African-Americans in protests like just happened at Clemson. And, you know, I really can't speak in terms of, as a scholar, on what people are doing. I really can't. And there's a big difference. There's a whole range of anti-racism from people who are so strongly anti-racist that they would work and do whatever they could, to others who would be careful, hopefully not to vote for someone they perceived who might enact racist policies, as minor as that. So I think it's a large continuum.
That is interesting. That's another one I just kind of point out when white people give their response to that question about whether or not that's accurate. I don't really see much evidence of white people being significantly, greatly pained by racism, even a small segment of white people. I've seen white people when they get upset about something and they say, hey, we need to get this done. This is a problem that we need to solve, where they get busy and they start getting passing laws, passing legislation, raising money. They make things happen. Even what's happening a little bit north of you, which HB2, where they get cracking if it's a problem and they want to get it solved. From what I've seen, even as something as small as maybe we should not have Tillman Hall on the campus of Clemson, and maybe we shouldn't have that anymore. I don't really see white people being greatly and sincerely pained about, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have this white supremacist name on one of our main buildings on campus. It doesn't seem that way to me, and many other things, but I could be in error. Before we get to the book, since we did have a current event.
And so could I should say I, too, can be in error. And you know, you would be much more, as an African-American, attuned to these things than I can claim to be. And most of my, you know, I can speculate about today, but most of my knowledge comes from the historical record, studying the historical record. It's hard to know really what's in people's hearts and things. It really is. I do know there are a lot of people who feel very strongly who are whites here at Clemson, that Tillman Hall, the name has to go. So what I worry about is those seems like the easier things to do than the tough issues that you get in your definition of racism, those structural issues in our society, which have not come in a vacuum, but have grown out of the horrible history of slavery, continued racism and discrimination, up to the current day. So I actually think that, you know, I think we probably disagree a little bit. Yes, Tillman Hall, it hurts, should be changed, it hurt him. But I think those are easier to do than deal with those tough problems.
I just want to point out
that are there, structural, intellectual problems. The reason that people today will say, well, you know, white people, my folks never owned any slaves. Or, you know, that was a long time ago, get over it. I think they do not understand the history. I do a lot of voting rights testimony, and, you know, until 1965, people often risked their lives to go to the very places today, and some of them are still alive, to have to try to register to vote.
Because of the efforts of Ben Tillman, in part. I just wanted to make sure that I got in, and Strom Thurmond as well. I just wanted to make sure that I got in. You kind of made my point indirectly, and I do, this is for listeners, I do feel like you could be using words in a way that are trying to confuse us. This could be just practice of racism going on. For you to say that it would be easy, one of the easier things to do would be to change the name of Tillman Hall. It hasn't been done. If that's one of the easy things to do and it hasn't been done, that just makes my point that you can't really have a large section, even a significant section of white people who are greatly pained about racism when you still have a staunch, proud white supremacist who bragged about killing black people and keeping black people out of Clemson and making sure that black people couldn't vote and making sure that whites could keep their foot on the neck of niggers forever. And set up the foundation for doing so in South Carolina and to some degree throughout the country, that you can't even get his name removed from the school. You can't even get his statue taken down at the State House. They did take the Confederate flag down, but Mr. Tillman still has a pretty big statue at the state capitol, unless I've been misinformed. You can't even do that. If that's, as you said, one of the easier things to do, that to me just, that speaks more than anything about how sincere and greatly pained white people are or are not, that we can't even do some of the easy things in working against racist white supremacy. That being said,
well, go ahead.
I just want to make sure we're covering as much as possible so we don't deviate too much.
Sure.
With the banana situation,
on campus?
Yeah, before we go, let me just say, though, there's a difference, I think, where you and I are talking past each other a little bit. I think it's easy as a white person who wants to be non-racist to say, let's get rid of Tillman's statue, let's take down Tillman, change the name of Tillman Hall. That's not the same thing as doing it. You know, they have to get it done. That's what you're saying. But I think it's a lot easier when you were asking me what have people done. I think there is a distinction, and there's a major difference. Those who are willing to stand up and say we need to change the name of Tillman Hall or we need to remove the statue or do something. But that is very different than getting it done, as you said. Because the people who are in power, and this goes to your definition of racism, are the ones who make those decisions or have that whole situation. You know about the Heritage Act in South Carolina, for example, right?
I'm not really even aware of a large number of white people who are even verbalizing that we should change Tillman Hall. That's kind of the point that I'm making. The doing part, yes, that would be most important, but I'm not even aware of a sizable portion of white people who are even just saying we should change Tillman Hall or Ben Tillman should have these statues come down. I'm not even aware of that to make my point.
There are a number of faculty here, white faculty, who have signed petitions to say just that. Nowhere close to as many as should, not a huge number, but there are some that are doing that.
And not a huge number. That. Not a huge number. And apparently they are not the most powerful people at Clemson because the name hasn't changed, which just further emphasizes my point.
Right.
With the bananas.
Well, you understand why they say that you understand why the president says that he cannot do it now, right? There's a Heritage Act that was part of the compromise that goes way back to 2001 when the flag, Confederate flag, was moved from the top of the State House to the Confederate soldier in front of the State House, where it was just removed after the Dylann Roof murder of the worshipers at Mother Emanuel. And part of the compromise was the building of a wall on recognizing African Americans. But even there it says none should be by name or recognized. So you might make out some, but you can't really tell. I mean, they were so afraid that the people in power, the legislator who worked out this compromise, they were so afraid that someone like a revolutionary like Denmark Vesey might be there that they didn't want that. So you don't have anybody by name on the State House grounds who's African American except for Strom Thurmond's African American daughter, who the family, SMA Washington, whose SMA Washington family added later. But the other part of that compromise was the Heritage Act, which is being challenged right now in court by a co-author of mine on a book on race in the Supreme Court. An attorney named Armin Dörfner is one of those. And they're challenged the Heritage Act. But it says now that no public building, any monument of historical, dealing with war, historical things, can be changed unless by the state legislature, and not just a majority vote, but a two-thirds majority of both the Senate and the House. That was a big debate about the Confederate flag. So it gets even more complicated. The legal system takes it out of the hands. Now, that's not an excuse for people to say, I think we need to change it and challenge the Heritage Act. But it's just not a direct relationship of we want the Tillman Hall changed, and the president or even the trustees say, yes, we're going to do it. Now, they could do that, but they would then be challenged by the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Do you follow me?
Oh, absolutely. I'm familiar.
But it feeds into your definition of racism. People who have the power can pull that kind of stunt. Now, when these statues all went up, African-Americans didn't even have a vote. There was no African-American in the legislature.
Right. I don't want to get too bogged down into the statue issue of it, just because position on these monuments has been that they should stay up. I would, if I had my druthers, the Confederate flag would still be up. It's not that I want them taken down. I would just rather have everybody understand why they're there and what that represents about whites. What does that mean about the system of white supremacy? I don't want to get too bogged down into all that, because I am not, and I've said this consistently on our program, I'm not one of the ones for taking any of this stuff down. Leave it up just to make sure that everybody is very clear on who Ben Tillman is, when that hall was changed, the name and all of that. Make sure everybody knows who Strom Thurmond is, what his legacy is. Make sure everybody's very clear about the Confederate flag, when it got placed at the state capitol, when they put the heritage laws in and all that. Just make sure everybody is very clear about what all this means, and even some of the white people that are responsible for these laws being in place. I would much rather have that than taking it down and trying to pretend that it was never there in the first place, because I'm not a fan of that. I think that just adds confusion. Before we get to your book, I just want to get quick clarification about the banana situation on campus this week. They placed some bananas on a sign, a banner, that was promoting some of the African-American resources on the campus of Clemson this week. This became a big to-do. I played an audio clip, news clip, at the beginning of the program. They said the perpetrators, I guess, came forward this week to admit that they did do this. They put these bananas there. To your knowledge, what has unfolded? Has there been any decision about possible punishment? And do you even know if the perpetrators, do we have confirmation that these were white people that did this?
I know nothing, but I may be just out of it. I do know that I marched on Wednesday. I believe, was that yesterday?
Yes, sir.
Yes, yesterday, in support of students who were sitting in. We didn't know they were sitting in at the time, but who wanted to march and call attention. The president, the provost, the acting dean, the students were all there. We met at the place where that happened in support of the students. A few of us did, a faculty, and marched over. Then the students actually sat in the administration building in protest of a number of things. And I don't know what's happened since then. You know, I've heard rumors, but I don't know much. I can send you an email the president sent out about what Clemson's trying to do, about trying to hire more minority faculty to increase the number of minority students, particularly African-Americans. And I just got that today. I haven't read it in detail, but I'm happy to send it to you. It might be of interest to you. And he was very circumspect about what he could not say, that there was a process. And so he didn't, at least yesterday, had not heard much. I don't know what's happening with the students who are sitting in. I have agreed to fast one day to support them. Because there was an email went out asking if people would be willing to, you know, support the students.
Fascinating. Yeah, I'll check out.
So that's sort of incidentally, I know you want to move on, but I do want to say, I think you and I are slight agreement on the money. What I want to do is tell the complete story. I think it's bad just to have Tillman's. Stature there. But because that doesn't, the things that are said there are just things that are about and the kind of things you did for white. We need to tell the whole story in a way. Or even better than that, I'm not so sure people need heroes. They do need role models. So we got Benjamin Mays here in South Carolina, also from Edgefield, who we could have a monument to him. I think these people learn their history from these monuments, from the names of buildings. If they, you know, learn their history from the book scholars wrote, then Age of Lincoln sold pretty well. My grandkids would be a lot better off in terms of their college fund, but they don't. These monuments and public history things are important because they send out, I think, messages. When I grew up in 96 South Carolina, there was one little marker, and it was to Preston Brooks, who is the congressman from South Carolina who in 1856 came, Charles Sumner, the abolitionist, for in retaliation for his speech, The Crimes Against Kansas, in which he insulted South Carolina, particularly Butler's relative. Now, every child, at least a little boy, who walked by that statue knew the way to get a plaque put up for you was to beat the fire to people. It's no wonder we were state champs in football. Those kind of markers are important. So we have to tell the whole story so that people understand.
Absolutely. And
so I just don't want to leave that hanging. I think you and I fear, as you do, that if we get rid of all these things, people will not even be more unclear as to why things are as they are now and why there are disparities in wealth and opportunity for people.
I just want to make sure that I'm being equally clear. It's not my opinion that it's white people who are confused or misinformed about all of this. I think white people, I think they got it. They understand. Mr. Butler, his statue up for the caning of Charles Sumner, Ben Tillman, Strom Thurmond, I think they got the message about why these people have these statues, what it means to be white, and these symbols, these representations of white supremacy. I think they got it. I think Dylan Storm Roof got it. He went to some of these monuments before he carried out his act of terrorism last summer. It's my opinion that white people got it. There's no confusion about that at all. And that's why you've had so many white people upset and even putting laws in to make sure that these statues do not come down easily, if at all. I think it's non-white people, black people, that are not clear about what these statues represent, what this means, even what this means about whites. To segue even right to your book, In My Father's House Are Many Mansions, because in my opinion, your book, it makes it very clear the history of South Carolina and how you get a Dylan Storm Roof, that these are not just random acts that, you know, happen out of nowhere. I can't believe this, that no, this is on a continuum of what it means to be white, not just in South Carolina, in the world, I would submit, but certainly South Carolina. This should not be a surprise to anyone that there's a long history of this sort of conduct on the part of whites terrorizing black people. In fact, they make monuments to whites who have terrorized black people in the state of South Carolina. Can't leave out J. Marion Sims, the infamous father of gynecology. The passage that you have in your book, this is on page 145. And my question to this, just your book, how does it explain what it means to be white, the history of racism, white supremacy in the state of South Carolina? I guess it would be Edgefield specifically, since that's what this book is focused on. But this is in the subset, Impact of Slavery on the White Family, where you write, although many whites were especially fond of certain bondsmen and saw their slaves as part of the extended family, I'm even thinking of Strom Thurmond, all white children learned racism. I'll rewind that back again just because I think somebody just said that white people are not misinformed or unclear about racism. All white children learned racism. Belief in the supremacy of whites was strong and ingrained, and whites closed their minds to any other viewpoint. Their racism was inspired in part by fear of the violence that loss of freedom could breed in the slaves. In this frontier-like region, violence was common. Whites fought whites. Blacks fought blacks. Whites and blacks attacked one another. Between 1844 and 1859, the Edgefield coroners recorded 65 murders. Whites killed 16 slaves, 14 men, and 2 women. Sometimes white Edgefieldians forced or hired slaves to kill other whites. This is the legacy of Ben Tillman that leads you to Dylan Storm Roof. Just can you, if you want to speak to this passage specifically and your book, what it reveals about what it means to be white supremacy in the state of South Carolina?
Well, I am, it's been a long time since I wrote that book, but in my memory, I think part of what I'd like to speak to is less about a general interpretation that I gave there is that something I believe very strongly is that people misunderstand what slavery was. They try to make it look like it was not this horrible thing. But slavery, you could not have had slavery except for two things. One, as opposed to the North, you could not have had slavery if you had segregation because you had to have white people there to enforce making African Americans enslaved. But along with that, and probably more important that people don't understand, is you could not have slavery without violence, or at minimum the threat of violence. So I really believe in the American South in particular that you have a culture of violence, of which that produced very much a culture of bravado, of sort of larger than life characters and extremism that comes out of a society that was based upon slavery, which could only be upheld through violence or the threat of violence.
Particularly violence against black people, would that be an accurate statement? Or the threat of violence against black people, would that be an accurate statement?
That's right. But, you know, that's the problem. That's something like violence. It extends everywhere. That's right. That's exactly right. But then if you have violence, If that's the answer, then that extends everywhere. So you have whites using it against whites. I mean, it's just becomes part of the culture, I think.
Absolutely. But, and just that statement that I think is hugely important, because in my view, that is another, just to be blunt, I think it's one of the biggest lies on the planet that white people are ignorant about racism, that white people are misinformed, or that they just don't have information, that they don't understand. That is hogwash. White people are the experts on racism. It's not Gus T. Renegade that's the expert on racism, folks. It is white people, folks like our guest, Mr. Butler. It's white people that are the experts on racism. They know this way better than we do. Your statement, do you think that that's still true? All white children learned racism. Is that still true, 2016?
Gus, you're breaking up on me. I can't hear you.
Oh, man.
Gus, I'm sorry, but you're breaking up somehow. Can you hear me okay?
Can you hear me okay?
I'm getting about every third word. Can you hear,
I can hear you. I can hear you crystal clear. Are you hearing me okay?
More important. Okay.
Are you hearing me okay?
Yeah, I can now, but for some reason, I am now, yes.
Okay.
For a moment there, I was getting about every third word.
Okay. I just, to repeat what I said, number one, that white people are the experts on racism, not Gus T. Renegade, and that I do not think that it is white people that are misinformed or poorly educated about racism. And I just, your statement that all white children learned racism, do you think that that is still true, 2016?
I think, you know, I don't know. I'm afraid I'd have to think about that. I think that people are more conscious now. I think we disagree. I think there are a lot of people who do not want to teach racism, who work toward it. I think a lot of our society, though, still has. I mean, things such as Black Lives Matter come right out of our history, not just pops up in things. But so much of it, I think you and I disagree, is unconscious now and unknowing. That we are so far removed in terms of years from enslavement or even the whole Jim Crow, that, you know, there are historians writing now who don't remember that until 1965 and then the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, that African Americans couldn't vote in the South. They just, and it's amazing to me the different interpretations that are coming out now. So I think we probably disagree, Gus. I think that a lot of it is people aren't informed. A lot of whites aren't informed and are unaware. And maybe that's because they don't want to be aware.
That, as I said, that is very common. I think many non-white people and many white people, when they speak about racism, not just on this program, but in total, that's the perspective that they give, and my rejoinder consistently is this: white ignorance about racism, number one, has to be it's a relatively recent excuse, because I just don't think it would make much sense in 1965 in South Carolina, Georgia, really anywhere, South Africa even, to say that white people are ignorant about racism when you have signs up that say no niggers allowed, whites only, what you said about voting and what have you. You cannot have all of that and have white people be ignorant about what this means. So number one, this has to be a very recent thing. I would say number two, it's been my experience, as I've said, most of the white people that I come in contact with, they tend to be a lot more informed about individuals like Ben Tillman, individuals like Strom Thurmond, even just going present day, they tend to have a much better understanding of what it means to be white than black people. White people are around other white people when there are no black people around, and they get to hear what is said about black people, non-white people, when it's only white people present. And I'm sure you being in South Carolina as a white man, have you been in the presence of exclusive white company when white people have made racist comments and just assumed that all the white people present were in agreement?
Yeah, I have, and I've tried to always make a conscious effort to speak out at that time. So it doesn't usually get as far. Maybe that's my fault. Maybe I should be quiet and listen, and I could really find out. But then people usually back off. As I said, I have three African-American grandchildren, so I immediately step up to that. And so I cut off conversation maybe too quickly. Maybe I should be smarter and more subtle and let people have their say. But I try not to, because I think that's part of the problem we have. And let me disagree a little bit with you. 1965 seems to me, I mean, I remember it well, but there are, you know, are generations since then, including African-American students who I have taught and others. We had this horrible incident of the Hamburg mask. We had that too. But of seven African-American students shot down and killed fleeing from the police, I believe it was Highway Patrol or National Guard, I've forgotten which now, at Orangeburg, 1968. And I've taught South Carolina history in this state at two schools now, and I have had not one white or black student from the state of South Carolina that knows about this. You know, they know about Kent State, where white kids got killed, but they do not know about the Orangeburg Massacre. And that is, you know, in contradiction to what you're saying, I think, that it's important to know this history, and people don't know it. You know, I would like to see us use these statues of Sims, the gynecologist, or the father of gynecologist, of Tillman, of James F. Byrne, and Strom Thurmond, to teach people that this was a society of white supremacy after, I mean, I guess part of slavery, whether you call that white supremacy or not. But certainly since then, that it was an effort, a deliberate and a legal and political effort to make the South a land of white supremacy. Like I say, you could not be my age and grow up and not know that. And that's what the civil rights movement was fighting against.
Mm.
But it's hard for me because it shows my age, but I am convinced that there are white and black people who have grown up now in the South since then, since 1965 in particular, when the Voting Rights Act is passed. It was enforced pretty quickly. So have come to age and are just unaware. And we don't teach it in our history books.
Mm. That may be the case, and I don't dispute that, that there are probably some white people and certainly some black people even who don't know about the Hamburg Massacre or any number of other incidents. Right. Strom Thurmond raping the black female who worked in his house and producing a child. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are not well informed about those different incidents of racism. The only thing I would submit, my original statement, it's been my experience that white people tend to be quite a bit more informed than non-white people about those incidents, in my experience. If we disagree there, that's fine. The other aspect that I would add, as a white person, you don't have to know the whole history of what happened under this system to practice racism. As a white person, all you need to know is what it means to be white, how you're supposed to function as a white person, and I strongly submit white people, they understand that. And if you don't, you will get in trouble with other white people. As I said just 5 minutes ago, white people, they are around other white people and hearing conversations about what white people think about Negroes. They're hearing this on a constant basis. It's everywhere. So even if you don't know all these little trivial moments of white supremacy all through the annals, that is not something that is going to keep you from being able to function well, efficiently, as a racist white supremacist. But again, Dylan Storm Roof wasn't ignorant about all this. He took photos at some of these monuments. He was not ignorant, Mr. Roof. Moving forward, in your book, a little bit forward, this is on page 236, where you write, and again, in my view, this book gives quite a few great details about what it means to be white, and you see that on a continuum in the system of white supremacy, the history in South Carolina, Edgefield specifically. And this segment right here, just in my view, you can relate it to the Hamburg Massacre that you just referenced in 1968. I believe these black students, I think they were at a bowling alley, if memory serves, that was quote-unquote, that was segregated, and the police came and
right, they were protesting segregation, legally protesting.
Right. This incident or any number of other instances, Walter Scott from last year or Dylan Storm Roof, particularly I'm reminded of Walter Scott. And if folks remember the image of him being shot in the back as he ran and then handcuffed after he was shot and killed, he was handcuffed, hands behind his back after he was killed. But this passage where you write, during the mass violence of Reconstruction, whites left the bodies of murdered blacks where they fell, which enabled them to shoot at those who attempted to retrieve them. Whites are well aware of the terrible effect their inability to bury the dead had on the African-American community. Well aware, you wrote. Matilda A. Evans, a black physician who as a young girl attended school near Edgefield County, later wrote of one such incident. A group of black men attempted to bury one of the bodies left on display. Because of white attacks, they had to put the murdered man in a pine box of cheap manufacture, just as the unhappy man had fallen, without a funeral, robe, or garment, in everyday old work clothes. Does this translate, this disregard for black life, even black death, does this translate in particular? Do you see any parallels with what happened with Walter Scott?
Well, I'm not sure you can take one exactly the other, but clearly, and I think Walter Scott, if I remember, was even worse. Didn't the person try to pretend that Walter Scott had a weapon and maybe put one down there? Or am I misremembering?
That you are correct, sir. Yes, sir.
And I think what there you have is a very, you know, of course, it hasn't gone to trial yet, but from everything I understand, example of racism by a police officer. I just do not believe that would have happened if that had been a white person running away, and it was all about, I guess, child support payments. It's why he was trying not to be, you know, caught in things. It's horrible, but I don't think that's quite, I mean, he did not want people to see what he was doing, whereas whites during Reconstruction wanted people to know the racism was, the white supreme racism, it was like a war. It was terrorism. I mean, we tend to think that 9/11 is when terrorism begins. But for African Americans in the South, at least from the end of slavery or during Reconstruction until after 1965, African Americans lived in a terrorist state. They were subject, and people could get away with it. This is why today people don't understand why people were so worried about Dr. King when he went to jail. And we know he went to jail and he got out of jail. But how many other Martin Luther King Jr. went to jail and were never, ever heard from again? How many other kids or African Americans were buried, you know, in Mississippi besides the three, the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi? I mean, there was no recourse. There was no justice. It was a terrorist, white supremacist, authoritarian society. It was based upon white supremacy.
Rich remains.
But today, I think what you see are the remnants of that. And instead of sort of wanting people to see what he's doing to Walter Scott, it's an individual act of horrible thing, but he's trying to cover it up. So I see a difference.
I guess
that's why I think people now know that racism is wrong, that the white supremacy is wrong, but we are often, you know, in this system of society, examples come out of that.
I would again submit it's my view, if you are a white person, I think exactly what you said about Mr. Calhoun earlier, South Carolina legend, that white supremacy is not wrong, and I see that today. I don't see what you called remnants. It's just continued. It looks a little different. You have alterations in how the system functions in the same manner as it did not function the same way in 1830 as it did in 1870, but it's still the same system. Looks different, same system. That, in my view, is what you have now. 2016 looks a little different, but it is the same system of white power, white domination over non-white people, and especially black people, and consistently violence or the threat of violence against black people, especially non-white people on the whole. To that end, I think even before I get to my next question, with the image where you said the white officer that shot Walter Scott last spring, almost a year ago to this day, that was video. There was video footage of what happened. Now, certainly the officer, he didn't shoot the video, and I'm sure he would have preferred to there not be footage. But just in my view, the fact that you have so much video footage of black people being shot, choked, killed, tased, maimed by enforcement officers, and the vast majority of the time, nothing happens. Nobody goes to jail. Frequently, no one is even indicted for these incidents. In my view, it serves the same purpose in reinforcing the cheapness, the lack of value for black life, and the system of white supremacy, the power that we have that we can take any black life, black child, whether it's Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, just insert names, Sandra Bland, anybody. We can do this at any time, and there's nothing that can be done about it. That, I think, it is, in my way, very similar to the passage that I just read about there is a ritual, a purpose to having these displays, because so frequently this footage becomes viral. It's on YouTube, and people can make their little memes and footage and that sort of thing, and there's been so much of that, and even many scholars, Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, she has a great piece where she's making the same point that these images are really, in some ways, modern lynch photographs that can be shared, joked about, commented on, and just reinforce the same idea of white terrorism and the cheapness of black life. But again, you know, I could be in error on that. And really, in the same vein, the question that I wanted to ask, you brought up the red shirts of the 19th century, Ben Tillman, and the terrorism that, you know, plagued South Carolina, and not just South Carolina, many regions after the Civil War in response to Reconstruction. You had black people that were terrorized, killed for trying to vote, or elected officials, where in Stephen Kantrowitz's Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, he writes about Benjamin F. Randolph, Simon Coker, black elected officials who were killed during this time period that Ben Tillman bragged about, talked about, encouraging this sort of violence to kind of put uppity niggers back in their place. Do you draw any comparisons to State Senator Clementa Pinckney being killed? Because some people I know have talked about Dylan Storm Bruce, that we should think about this as a political assassination, what happened to him last year. What are your thoughts on that?
I hadn't really thought about it except in the context of B.F. Randolph was actually a member of that same church, AME, you know, Mother Emanuel mm-hmm. Church, which was a leading political a group of people had come out to a church with extraordinary history dating back to Denmark Vesey and others. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. I really hadn't had time to think about it. I think it was clearly an act of white terrorism. I'm not sure if he knew that he may have. I just don't know if he knew that Reverend Pinckney, in fact, was a state senator. He probably did, but I don't know for sure, so I won't state. It's certainly an act of terrorism and white supremacy. It's much more in line with sort of like a what worries me about going on today, the kind of things that one would expect in Nazi Germany than in a society of laws, even laws that have been unfair.
If, excuse me, unless I'm misinformed, was Dylan Storm Roof, was he seated next to Clementa, Reverend and State Senator Clementa Pinckney for approximately an hour before he began his terrorist violence? Wasn't he seated next to Clementa Pinckney?
I don't know. I know he was there with them in the Bible study, as I understand it, but I don't know.
I'm pretty sure.
I
always say strive for accuracy. I could be in error, but I'm pretty sure I'd be willing to bet a few coins from the reports that I read that he was seated next to Reverend Clementa Pinckney before the shooting began. And I'm very sure I'm accurate on this. Reverend Clementa Pinckney had been speaking out vocally about the Walter Scott shooting months before the shooting, where he was on television, he was in the state legislature, talking about police violence against black people, racism in South Carolina. He had been talking about this pretty publicly. I find it hard. And again, Dylan Storm Roof was not dumb. He had been going to state monuments about slavery and white supremacy and taking photos of himself at all these places. He wrote his manifesto where he detailed all of his grievances, almost suggesting that black people were practicing racism against whites, where he outlined his grievances. I would find it hard to believe that Dylan Storm Roof didn't know that Reverend Clementa Pinckney was a state senator in South Carolina. But again, maybe some of this will come out in the trial.
You're probably right. I have not personally looked into it that way, is all I'm saying. But I suspect you're right. But again, as a historian, I can't say I know that. Or if I were an expert witness on the stand, it would be, it certainly makes logical sense that he would, particularly after what you said.
Right on. A few more of them. I definitely want to make sure that I get some of our listeners an opportunity to ask a few questions if they have anything that they want to ask, particularly even about your testimony in Mr. Whitfox's case. That's fascinating. I didn't even know you were involved with that case because we talked about that as well.
And I also, yes. And they may be interested. I was the expert witness for the LDF, NAACP LDF, in the Texas photo voter ID case, and the judge who ruled against the Texas voter ID actually used my testimony as the basis to make the argument. And I was also the expert witness against the South Carolina photo voter ID law, and the Justice Department cited my report there as to why they objected to the South Carolina voter ID. So, and I find that very interesting because I do think there you and I may find some agreement in terms of these are the very same kind of laws that Ben Tillman put in and was trying to put in. I mean, so similar. It really is frightening. I mean, there is such a parallel. They're modern-day poll taxes, basically.
Fascinating.
So, I mean, you can directly go from the 1890s, you know, straight into
21st century.
Yeah, well, I was trying to think of the dates. Now, 2012 was the trial. I remember that very well for South Carolina, and it must have been 2013 or 14 for Texas.
As I've said, that is the system of white supremacy. You will see some adjustments, certainly, but it's still the system functioning in many of the same ways with many of the same objectives in terms of dominating black people. You certainly very familiar with Mr. Tillman. We read one of the biographies on him. There are others where he talked about white women, and he referenced them. Mr. Kantrowitz's book, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, he focuses a lot on patriarchy, as does your book as well, the role of patriarchy in South Carolina and how that organized white families and even black families. He had a term where he referenced, it was a term of reverence for white women, sun-browned goddesses, and talking about their labor out in the sun and having to work so hard to keep white families rolling. And you have a few passages in your book where you talk about the role of white women, which I think is important. A lot of times we talk about racism, white supremacy, it gets very focused on white men, the Dylan Storm Roofs, the Ben Tillmans, the Strom Thurmonds. I submit you cannot have a system of white supremacy without white women being knowing equal accomplices in this criminal endeavor. You have, this is on page 152, where you write, make sure I give proper context. This is in your section talking about the white family, where, let's see, according to the memoir, Mrs. Butler interposed, telling her husband that they were her children as well as his, and to have the slaves break any future cults. Although he did not like it, General Butler gave in to his devoted wife. Butler's interesting tale supports the contention that the 19th century woman played a definite role in running the family unit and that she was not a mere adjunct to her husband's life and wishes. Devoted did not mean subservient, as some literary stereotypes indicate. I'm going, just skipping down to the next page on 153. You write, former slaves often recalled white women as influential in plantation decision making. They were, in general, favorably disposed to their white mistresses, yet there were exceptions. The various temperaments and personalities of individual owners often determined the treatment of slaves. Peggy Grigsby remembered that her Edgefield owner was a fair master, but his wife was awful mean to us. Just can you talk about the role of white women in this period, and even you, if you want to go contemporary, how this continues today, the role of white women in maintaining white supremacy?
Well, I think we've already discussed a little bit, but of course, Tillman and so many white men used the excuse of white women. This was Tillman's excuse as to why he justified lynching, of course. was protection of white women. So this holding women up on a pedestal. There's been more work since my early work here and in my father's house and many mansions, you know, that suggests that this is was a two-way street, that women expected to be treated, white women expected to be treated a certain way. And, of course, the Civil War really was a major shift when suddenly men were all fighting away. And all of these kind of things that women were supposedly protected from, they have to deal with now, like running a plantation or a farm, dealing with enslaved people to try to manage the plantation. So I do think the Civil War was a major shift. But and I'm not quite sure of the question. I think that, you know, our whole history, one of the reasons the United States is different, say, than Latin America, I believe, is we had pretty well equal populations in terms of male-to-female ratios among whites and African-Americans, whereas in Latin America and Brazil, it was mainly men who were imported. And what you had were situations where, in fact, in Latin America, quite often, it was frequently that a white man took an African-American woman as his mistress, I don't know what would be the proper term to call, and acknowledged that, and acknowledged his children. And so you actually had all sorts of sort of gradations. There's not just white or black. There was a historian named Carl Daigler at Sanford, who used to call it the mulatto scape hatch. But you have all these, one is not just black or white, and so many of these children of black women and white men in Latin America sort of became the bureaucrats that ran the country, did well. But in the American South, I think, in particular, I don't want to sound like I'm blaming women, but the part, you still have the same thing happen, that men in power, white men, take advantage of African-American women by whatever means. When one has power in those relationships, it's wrong. But women, because there were a lot of white women in the United States, said this is morally wrong, didn't stop it, but it did, and therefore people have not acknowledged, in fact, the black and white children from white men in the South. I mean, there are exceptions, but in general, they did not, and take the responsibility, these are my children, and these are... you know, I'm going to make sure that I leave money to them and inheritance. So I think there's a major difference, just the demography that's made a difference between race relations in the United States, where one is either black or white, the kind of questions you were asking me at the beginning, and where in Latin American countries it's not seen that way. Does that make sense to you? Are you following me, Gus?
I understand what you're saying, and that,
yeah,
again,
don't have to agree.
Oh, it's not a question of agreement. I just submit it's a system of white supremacy. And absolutely, you have all sorts of different classifications. We've talked about Brazil before and other different areas of the world where you still have white supremacy. You might have a lot of different racial classifications to term people, but white still dominates wherever you happen to be at. We've discussed that in a few different contexts on the broadcast. One of the things that stood out more significantly to me when you were talking about white men in positions of power and how you classify what they're doing to enslaved black females under white supremacy, if we're talking about formal plantation-era slavery or any other future points, in my view, the most logical, the most accurate way of describing this is rape. That's what this is. We had the Sublets, Constance and Ned Sublet. They were on the program earlier this year. Their book, The American Slave Coast, where that's kind of the central point of their book, is that it's one of the same points you bring out in your book, that the population of black people during the antebellum period, it increased. Because of sexual intercourse that was going on in the plantations, where you actually had an increase in population here, where you didn't have to bring in black people from the continent or elsewhere. You had natural increase, quote unquote, but they just make sure to submit that this is rape, whether it's plantation masters, white racists forcing black enslaved black males and black females to procreate amongst themselves, or whether it's the black plantation master himself is going out and raping these black females and producing offspring, that this forced, required rape is what produced this natural increase in the enslaved population here in the states. And I just wanted to see, number one, if you think that that's accurate, is that logical? And just to make sure, because rarely do I hear people classified in those terms, which in my view is another act of racism, white supremacy, and not being correct in the way that we talk about this. And is that same white supremacist power dynamic, is that in play with someone like Strom Thurmond, who in my view raped, and it's not just rape, it would be child rape, because this was a teenager that he produced a child with, and this is in the 20th century, 1940s, I think, when he had this child. Is that same racist power dynamic in play? Would it be accurate to say what he did was rape?
Yeah, well, I think by law it is, isn't it? Statutory rape, just by age?
Absolutely.
There are these horrible racist laws. I remember one in the Antebellum period where there was one law that was so horribly written. I want to be careful because I can't quote it, but the idea that they used a different term when a white man raped a black woman. They didn't use the term rape. They came up with some. But then they said there is no law in the world against a black man, you know. Right? I mean, it was unknown to the, I think it says unknown to the law. It gives you how terrible this was. Yes, I would agree. And let me qualify. I would agree that it is rape every time. I do think, though, that what you discovered, it was not just forced rape of black men, of black women, but black men and black women loved each other and against all odds formed extraordinarily devoted relationships and families. That I do not see as forced rape. I think these were people who were in love. This is black, you know, African Americans, who some went to against master's wishes, particularly when there were different plantations and things like that, to form families that were extraordinarily strong during slavery. It's just sort of a surprise as we get into the historical record to see that one of the things that is most important to African Americans is their family.
Oh, for sure. And that is a point that you do bring up in the book. You spend a good bit of time of talking about this. I don't have a disagreement other than I would not say that these are quote unquote strong families. If you can be sold or beaten or raped at any time, to me, that does not signify strength. Even though I definitely agree you did have a lot of black people who placed an incredible value on attempted families and taking care of each other as best they could under absolutely horrendous circumstances. The only thing I would submit, and again,
when I talk about strong families, I'm saying about their emotions toward each other, their devotion toward one another.
Right.
You're right, and I hope I make clear in the book that in this patriarchal society, at the center becomes the white male who, no matter how supposedly paternalistic they are, ultimately, if it was a financial trouble or something like that, then it was the black families which were sold off, right, and children separated, husband, wives. It's a horrible.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's part of, you know, I mean, and I think that's part of the terrorism, a different kind of terrorism. When I say a terroristic society, but during slavery, that was part of the slavery system that is so horrible. It's not the kind of violence of terrorism of just killing people or you know, hanging them and lynching them, but it's another kind of terrorism that people had to live with. I guess they didn't have to, they killed them, but lived with to survive.
Absolutely. And I just, again, the work of the American Slave Coast, absolutely, you did have black males and females who cared about each other, tried as best they could to take care of each other, and even produce children under those settings. But the strong thesis of the American Slave Coast is that people like Thomas Jefferson, white racist planters, they understood, and very early in the enslavement system, that, whoa, our estate increases literally every time that these black people produce a child. That is our bank. We have more money. That's another child that I can sell. That's another field hand. That is more money for me in the bank. Literally every 9 months when they produce a child, we got to make sure that we have fertile black females, that was a huge point driving to make sure that you can procreate and that your value as a black female, enslaved black female, decreases. If you're not able to produce children, you're worth less money. It might be more difficult for you to be sold, that sort of thing, that this was a huge tenet of the slave system in this part of the world, as you talk about in your book, this natural increase. You did mention religion in the conversation and talking about that. I submit that what we're really viewing is the religion of white supremacy. You have a section in your book. It's titled Religion as a Means of Social Control. And I just want you to comment if you think in any way this could be related to what you mentioned earlier when you talked about some of the victims of the Mother Emanuel AME incident of white terrorism last summer, Dylan Storm Ruth, where you talked about their faith. Their religion, them coming forward and saying, hey, we forgive you, Dylan Storm Roof. We're not going to hate you. We're going to wish mercy for you and grace and their religious convictions and how that really stood out in the days after the massacre. Does this in any way relate to what you talk about in the book? This is on page 154 where you write, again, this is in the subheading Religion as a Means of Social Control, where you write, planters sought to use religion and churches as devices for social control. They hoped that their slaves would be more manageable if they attended church and heard white preachers reciting such passages as Ephesians 6:5, servants be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh with fear and trembling in singleness of your heart as unto Christ. In a debate on the best method of managing Negroes, sponsored by Edgefield District's Agricultural Club, J.J. Boyd argued that the surest technique was that which rendered them contented. Different slave owners viewed matters of control differently, but Boyd debated just and liberal treatment. And I will stop there just talking. Oh, wait a minute. Let me read just a little bit more. In reply to another Edgefield planter who argued for corporal punishment, Boyd said that slaves must have moral and religious training. This training included instructing slaves on the duties of Christian marriage and the need to work better for the master. Another planter agreed with Boyd and argued that every slaveholder is bound to the religious instructions of his slaves. Religion does not make a servant insubordinate. The religion of Christ does not make him proud, but humble and submissive. When the master has made his servant a Christian, he has accomplished much. Glad I read the rest of that. Does any of this relate to what you saw transpire in the days after the massacre at Mother Emanuel AME last year?
No, I think it's all related because it's faith and religion. But what I think you saw there instead is the same kind of theory that Martin Luther King Jr. used, that Dr. Benjamin Mays used, that even, you know, not Christian, but Gandhi used in terms of civil disobedience, in this case, very Christian theology of love your enemies. While it's related, I don't think that is, at least for my interpretation, would be the same. I think, in fact, if the families had come out and cursed him, et cetera, or something like this, then that would have fit in very nicely with white supremacy, saying, see, here's what we got. I actually think these folks changed people's, at least made people see things that had been there all along, but they hadn't recognized, and to hopefully start a change, at least I'm hoping so. We're probably just going to disagree on this, but that's okay. I have hope, and I may be wrong on this one.
I'll let listeners
and my own faith affects me. You know, I'm biased on this. This is important to me. I want to believe this. So that could be, you know, what's affecting my interpretation too. But I am a person of faith, and I think it is something. The other part I write about black religion, of course, is how blacks took it and made it their own, and how African Americans used that, in fact, other cutting edge. And I think this is exactly what Clementa Pinckney did and these families, to say, in fact, religion was a way for an apolitical people. That is, in slavery, people didn't have the right to vote and vote out their master or anything like that. But what they could do is there was a higher law, there was a higher judgment, And you see example after example, which I put it in my father's house to mention, that is opposed to accepting the negative stereotypes that white supremacists were trying to place upon African Americans, that they turned that around and said, as one preacher pointed out, you know, at the judgment day, one African American exhorter is what they called African American preachers at the time, slave preachers, enslaved people who were preachers. He said, you know, at the judgment day, there's going to be, you know, the sheep and the goats, and we know who has the wool, pat his head, and the white slave owner who was listening wrote it down. He said, he just said the whites are going to hell, and, you know, that blacks are going to be the lambs, and they're going to be the ones who are saved. It was a way to pass judgment on others. So I think that that religion cut both ways, and while it has been used by many, many to keep African Americans down and from protesting, it's also been one of the most effective means for survival and for social advancement and cutting into white supremacy. I think people forget. I mean, they look at King and they forget that he was a Baptist minister. This was very important to him. This is who he was. And gave him that kind of strength to go forward. My favorite example is Benjamin Mays.
I generally point out Denmark Vesey, who's been brought up several times, and even Nat Turner, though he was in Virginia, not South Carolina, that these were also black people of faith who said, because of my faith, I'm going to do everything I can to resist white supremacy. Did so. I will go ahead.
And Gabriel Prosser as well.
Absolutely.
And Gabriel Prosser in Richmond, the other, all the three great black insurrectionists, there are a lot more, but all of them had religion as part of their thing. So I think it's a mistake to see it just as something whites wanted to see it that way. They wanted to believe that that's what it did. But I think that the Bible was read in a revolutionary way. You certainly see that in Turner. And the message of the Bible is a revolutionary message, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And one just cannot. While the pro-slavery theorists argued, the Bible, says that slavery is right and slavery is there, what it doesn't say, what the Bible never said, of course, is that there was racial slavery. It never justifies that. And this is one of the things, when I started out, we didn't go there, about societal racism and intellectual racism. It's very interesting to me. I wrote about this more in The Age of Lincoln. This earlier book came out, many years ago, 30 or so. I forgot how many years back. But one of the most interesting things is, with the civil rights movement, people in the white churches, the supposedly white Christians, they didn't have the power of the pro-slavery argument that theologians like at Yale and others said, yes, God says slavery is right, that, the Bible justifies slavery. Nowhere did the Bible justify segregation. They never had that. There was no authority. There was no biblical, and that's so much a part of this religious culture of the South. I think that's a major difference. Not to say that it was easy with the civil rights movement. You had violence and all the things of white terror that we've talked about, but you didn't have that intellectual basis. And that's what I find is so fascinating today, that is changing. It scares me so badly. Do you want to go there, Gus, or I'm taking you off? I didn't mean to get off on a lecture. Do you want me to go ahead just a little bit more to say how it relates to today, I fear?
If you could give our listeners a chance to get in a few questions, and then I'll allow you to just pick back up right there.
I don't have to. I just think right-wing radio, that people now think that they have authority. They are not intellectuals. They are not theologians. They're not. But for the first time since the civil rights movement, you now have all these right-wing radio TV hosts who people think of as scholars and intellectuals, and they believe there's a sort of intellectual authority that feeds back into their prejudices that reinforces that continuing racism that you've talked about. At any rate, that's where I was going to show you the difference, where I think you and I may disagree about what's happening and happened. And I'm frightened.
I'm sure some of our callers are going to ask for some connections on Ben Tillman to Donald Trump, so you'll be able to expound on that a bit more, I suspect, as we hit the phone lines. The number for people who have a question for historian Professor Vernon Burton, feel free. The number is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. *6 if you would like to participate. We'll get your hand if you have a question. Thomas in New York, if you had a question for Professor Burton, you should be with us, sir.
Good evening, Gus. How are you this evening, Mr. Burton?
Greetings.
Professor, greetings to you. I would like for you to, first I would just make a quick comment that I don't think it's a wise idea for black people to be praying to a God who looks just like the people oppressing them. But my question for you is how exactly do you have African-American grandchildren?
My daughter is married to an African-American.
Okay. That'll be interesting. Okay, my next question for you, quickly, have you ever...
One of my daughters, I should say.
Have you ever yourself been in a sexual relationship with an African-American?
No.
Okay, very good. My question for you, and I have a couple here. I had some about 96, but you took me on a whole other tangent here. What would happen if no blacks decided to go to Clemson anymore? They decided not to play football, not to play basketball no more. They're not going to help Clemson meet their minimum quota of campus diversity. I'm sure they get a huge check from the government for having. Do you think that would get some of those things taken down on the campus that black people want taken down?
Yeah, well, I want to preface this by saying I'm a historian and not a prophet. They were having my book, The Age of Lincoln, won an award, and I was at a book signing in Chicago, and there were about four people over there to buy my book, and there was a line you couldn't even see all the way down the street. And finally, during the break, I asked the lady who she was, and she was the woman that had written the book that they based that TV show, The Medium, off of, and I knew I was in the wrong business. If I was a prophet, I'd make a lot more money. But I did say this in public early on about the Tillman statue. I said the day that African-American athletes say that we're not going to play football at Clemson, then you would see Dabo Swinney, the coach, calling for, changing the name. So I do think it would have an effect that way, at least with the athletic program. I mean, we almost won the national championship on the basis of great athletes and probably none better than Deshaun Watson as quarterback. And I think that would make a difference. But you'd be surprised sometimes at how, it's complicated for individuals. I mean, it's easy to talk about racism. Maybe it's not easy, actually, to talk about it. But, individuals, I think, are different. I think each individual is different, black and white, as to how they approach and look at things. It's interesting because I have argued all my life that whites make a mistake to see all blacks the same. That's one of the things that bothers me. I'm really happy they have this wonderful black monument up for African Americans. It's very moving on the State House ground. But where are the individuals?
Without their names.
Where are the leaders and models we can point out? But I think it's also a mistake for African Americans to say that all whites are the same or all black athletes are the same. But I do think it would make a huge difference. With the athletes, I'm not sure it might be an easy excuse for people if minorities did not come. And I do think you need that both for the minorities and for whites to have education. This world we're living in is in the 21st century is a diverse world, and people have to learn. And that's the only learning environment, I think, that can make sense in today's world. Did I answer your question?
You kind of answered it, and then you added a lot of rhetoric, but I got the gist. Do you think that, has anyone ever accused you of being a racist?
I've actually been accused by whites of being racist. It's whether they have, I don't know, to my face.
Why would the white person accuse you of being a racist?
For arguing about the kind of things that I have wrote about, things like that. They say that I only see black perspective. They're wrong, but that's why they have accused it. The facts, you know, point out. So this is the early discussion, you know, can African-Americans be racist in a society in which all the power and things are sort of in whites? But there's a debate. I mean, people don't think it. Whites often don't think in those terms.
Okay, and my last question for you, and thank you for letting me get my questions in, Gus. 96 South Carolina was started by Sephardic Jews in the 1700s, am I right?
I don't know. I thought it was it was an outpost, sort of between Charleston and where I am now, Clemson, Kiowee, which was a major business center of the Cherokee Nation. But I just don't know. I know that someone was one of the first Jews killed in the American Revolution was killed there, was from there, was fighting in the American Revolution. I don't remember the founder. I thought it was an outpost. I'm sure there were some Jews who were there, but I think it was more of just a backcountry outpost that grew. Was during the Regulator Movement, there was a jail built there and a courthouse so people didn't have to go to Charleston. But you may know more about it than I do. It's the home of Dr.
You might know because you were a historian. But since you don't have too much information on that, I'll let someone know, get their questions, and thank you.
All right, thank you.
Ross, did you have a question for Professor Burton? You should be with us.
Hi, yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Burton. I did have a couple of questions. The first question is very early in the program. You were talking about during some of your work as far as advocating for different black people that were in prison, that a lot of times or sometimes people thought that you were an African-American. And I'm paraphrasing, but you alluded to it kind of being, I guess, like a positive thing or maybe even a badge of honor for them to assume that you were African-American. And I just wanted to know, why was that or why do you feel that way?
It was less for that. That I conflated two things. And I've done a lot of expert witness work, particularly on school or integration. The Alfred Woodfox case was different in the sense that people knew who I was by then. But as a young scholar, when I was writing about particularly this book that Gus is using and the article Race and Reconstruction, and I was telling a story somewhat different than had been told before, then a number of people assumed that I was African-American. And here's one of the weird things. I know it sounds strange, but my name being Orville Vernon Burton, it just sounded not to me. It doesn't necessarily sound anything but, you know, family names. But some people even took that as part of it.
All right, thank you. And my second question is, earlier you had said that we were today, in modern times, we're seeing the remnants of racism, white supremacy, and that it wasn't the same as it used to be in the antebellum period. And I wanted to know, how could you say that we're only seeing the remnants of racism, white supremacy, when essentially black people are in the same position today that we were during slavery, in the sense that we don't have any control over any areas of people activity? And when I say people activity, I mean economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, war, and healthcare. Black people have no control over any of those aspects of their lives the same way that our ancestors didn't. The only difference is today that we don't have this physical change. So I just wanted to know, how can you actually say that we're witnessing the remnants of white supremacy today?
I don't think they're remnants of white supremacy. I think white supremacy is real and there. I think what we're seeing in specific instance I was talking about, I agree with you. I don't think it is the same, however. I think with the vote, people have some say-so, not as much as they should have. But I think it's very different from slavery. Slavery was about as horrible as one can get into. There's nowhere is there equality, but I think there is a great deal of difference between slavery, even Jim Crow, and now. That doesn't say there's not racism, and it certainly doesn't say there's not white supremacy.
All right, thank you. My final question is, with the political climate being what it is today and the popularity of a racist like Donald Trump and someone like Hillary Clinton, who has a long legacy of imprisoning multiple generations of African-American males, most recently her husband came to her defense publicly for her stance on calling African-American males super predators, would you say that the popularity of both of those candidates, would you say that racism, white supremacy is white culture? And that's my final question. Thank you.
Okay. I don't. And, I actually think that it's a mistake to say clearly that Hillary Clinton is doing the imprisonment thing. She has said, and even Bill Clinton in his better moments has said, they made mistakes on that crime bill. And that's actually that crime bill is what caused Mr. Woodward to not get out of jail the first time that he would have. It was wrong. But I don't think they are the ones who are doing it. And I do think that Hillary Clinton inappropriately used language when she was running against Barack Obama. But I think it would not be fair to say that she has imprisoned people.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that she actually imprisoned them. I was just saying, based on their popularity, would you say that white supremacy is white culture? And if you don't think it's white culture, what would you classify as white culture?
Well, I think that, like with African Americans, there are different groups of whites. People think different ways. I think white supremacy is, in fact, goes beyond white culture. I think white supremacy has been a lot of ways institutionalized, and hopefully we can find ways to change that. One of the ways is the voting, and through the vote. It's a cliche, and I don't mean to just throw this up and think, but you do have, major difference. Barack Obama is a man of African descent, and he's president of the United States. That's pretty remarkable. The wealth of an Oprah Winfrey. It's pretty remarkable. That doesn't excuse what's the situation for everyone else, but it is different in a culture of white supremacy. The white supremacy was almost a totalitarian society before 1965, certainly up into World War II and there. I don't think it is like that now. I think one of the things you can look at is the return migration. African Americans have been leaving the South at every opportunity, and for good reason. In 1970, you started having more African Americans move back to the South than were leaving. So now there's a pretty large migration into the South. And I put that directly related to the Voting Rights Act.
Appreciate that, Roz, our caller in Michigan, female caller. Did you have questions for Professor Burton? Your line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners and to your guests. I do have a couple of questions. You classify yourself as a white man, correct?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. A white...
You classify yourself as a white man?
That's the way I am classified, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Do you think it's possible to not practice racism as a white person in the system of racism, white supremacy?
I don't know. I would try not to, or do try not to, but there is... there's so much institutionalized situations that it's hard not to, I think. I think individuals can try. I think you can make a choice to try not to. It doesn't mean you'll succeed, but I would hope that you could try.
Okay. Have you practiced or mistreated black people in your lifetime? Practice racism in any kind of way, and if so, how?
I bet that I have, but I don't know of any specific example, unless when I was younger, that's different, I think, that I would not speak up when family or someone was saying something I thought inappropriate. But that's not quite the same thing as mistreating the individual. I would hope not. I tried. I took the Bible very seriously and was taught, my whole life by my mother that all of the children of God were all brothers and sisters. And though I know I made lots of mistakes, I tried to live that way.
Okay, so you consider yourself a Christian, is that correct?
I do, yes, ma'am.
Okay. My last question, I was clear on Gus stating that he feels that non-white people are most confused about racism, but I wasn't too clear on your position, so I just wanted to know if you can clarify, who do you feel is most confused about racism, white people or non-white people, and why?
Well, I think white people are the most confused because we want to deny that it exists. I would say definitely it would be white people who are most confused about white supremacy. We don't see it. We don't see white privilege. We don't see how that we are benefactors of white privilege. I grew up with a very good friend. I used to like to say there was only a non-segregated cow pasture between our houses. He was a little bit older than I am. He's now in Albany, New York. But we were both grew up relatively poor. He, though, was African-American, and I was white. And people rewarded a hard-working white kid, and I had opportunities. He should have been president of the United States. He was, and still is, you know. So smart and hardworking and things, but that was part of that society.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for answering my questions and thanks for taking my call, Gus.
For sure. Caller at 9828. Did you have a question for Professor Burton?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a couple questions for Professor Burton. One question is, I would like to know, is he pro-colonialism or is he anti-colonialist?
If I understand what you mean by colonialism, I'm anti-colonialism. I assume you're talking about colonies and countries controlling other countries?
Yes, I'm talking about the history of the United States. I am talking about the history of the United States.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, I'm against colonialism, but I'm a historian. I have to deal with that we have been a colonial power, that we colonized other areas. But, yeah, I think it's wrong.
Now, when you say we, are you talking about the white collective?
Yes, the country, the United States.
No, sir, I'm not talking about the land mass. I'm talking about a group collective of people that classify themselves as white. And I will repeat my question again. When you say we colonized and it was wrong, are you talking about the white collective or are you talking about a landmass called the United States?
Well, I don't know. I hadn't really thought it through. It's a good question.
Wow.
You know, it's part of
are you saying that the landmass could have colonized it was not the white collective, it was the landmass that colonized. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know what you mean.
Or was it the group collective of people that colonized? Or was it the landmass? Was it the United States that colonized Native Americans? The landmass that colonized the Native Americans? Or was it a group of people from Europe that had nothing to do with the landmass that colonized the white collective? I mean, that colonized the Native Americans?
It was a group of people.
Oh, okay. That's all I wanted to know. So when you say we are wrong for colonizing, when you say we, are you talking about the white collective? Or to be more exact and specific, who do you mean when you say we?
Well, I meant the United States as a people, as a country.
Now, well, again, we're going in circles. When you say the United States, you're talking about a landmass where different ethnicities exist within this landmass. So I am not talking about the landmass. I am talking about a group of people. I'm asking, when you say we, are you talking about every ethnic group that exists in the United States, it colonized Native Americans? Or are you talking about specifically the group classified as white?
I'm talking about particularly the political group that did it, however they are, no. Whoever they were.
Sir? Well, I'll just move on. I'll move on from that because I think it's obvious that you're not ready to deal with that question. I will move to my second question.
I don't want to ignore your question. I guess I don't understand it. I'm sorry. That's my fault, but I don't understand it. The history of the United States has been one of colonization. I think that was horrible. That was bad. People did it to other people. In particular, those who were in political control are the ones who were probably most responsible. But, you know, I don't really know that. It's not really my specific area of expertise, so I'm just confused by the question.
Okay. You are an educated, like a doctor, college professor, a historian, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Me, I never even went to college. Barely got out of high school, right? Truck driver, that's my career. So I'm not an educated guy, but I do have enough, I say, common sense, I would say just sense, to know that when I'm asking a question, are you accusing the landmass or every group, ethnic group in the United States of colonizing Native Americans? You want to dance around that and act like you don't understand? Am I asking, are you placing the blame totally on the white collective? I will play naive with you also. But I will also move on to my second question, because I know other people have questions also. My second question would be, I heard you say that this generation is far removed from Jim Crow and slavery. Am I correct or incorrect?
That's not what I said. I think the effects are there. I think there's a younger generation who grew up and do not remember Jim Crow, the terrible kind of authoritarian legal segregation and discrimination. No, we're not that far. In fact, I said just the opposite. There are people who risked their lives if they had gone to places that now they have to go to register to vote. So it affects them.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's not at all far removed, but there's a generation that's grown. I think we're being naive to think there hasn't been a generation that's grown up since then and do not remember what that was that has had such effect on people since. Is that clear?
Well, I kind of, in my opinion, I kind of look at it kind of different than you look at it. I understand what you're saying, that they didn't physically live in Jim Crow. So I do understand that part, but about the far removed part of the people that didn't, you know, I'm 35 years old, right? And I don't know if I'm...
Yeah.
Sir?
Go ahead. It's
all right, but anyway, what I was saying is I'm 35 years old. I'm not going to say I'm old, and I'm not going to say I'm a teenager, a teeny bopper. You see what I'm saying? No, I'm a 35-year-old grown man. But I would say I would classify as a millennial, the one who probably got the right to vote around the turn of the millennium. You see what I'm saying? So when I'm looking at this word far removed, far removed, far removed, I was born in 1980, 12 years after the assassination of Dr. King. I represent a generation of African-Americans, you know, 35, 40, 20 years old, 20s, 30s, and 40s. I represent a group of African-Americans, or a generation of African-Americans that are not far removed. I don't know where this idea of far removed, or even that we have no idea even come from. We represent the first generation that never lived in Jim Crow. No, I'm not saying that we represent the second generation that never lived in Jim Crow. We represent the first generation that was never born in Jim Crow. So that means our parents were in Jim Crow. That's not far removed. That means the people that raised us grew up in the Holocaust, genocide, however you want to label it. So I think the toss around words, I even insinuate that we are far removed is suspect, to say the least. But I'll mute my line and continue to listen and learn, and thanks to both of you all.
Appreciate that. The person that called in, this is our retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Professor Burton?
Yes, sir. Greetings to the callers and the hosts. To the guests. I would just like to ask you a series of questions to you personally. Are you interested in solving the problem?
Yes, sir.
Okay, in this tremendous problem, which is the greatest problem that exists amongst people, with any problem, you have to make some sacrifices. To what extent are you willing to sacrifice in order for this problem to be solved?
I guess I don't understand the question. I think I'm willing to do whatever I can to
otherwise I would excuse that as a reaction to what I'm asking you, and I've heard this before at least twice on this interview. We are talking to someone who is a scholar, who is a writer, and I know that I am crystal clear on what I'm asking you. And for you to say you don't understand the question,
I guess I don't understand what you
That you may be practicing racism and white supremacy right now. I'm going to ask the question again. Are you willing to sacrifice? To what extent? There was a person that you and I know by the name of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King who was willing to sacrifice his life. He talked about it before it actually happened. So I know you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Now, you can answer me in whatever way you want to answer. But that particular answer you gave, reaction or answer you gave, it told me, it registered to me as a victim of racism, white supremacy, that you're practicing racism by saying you don't understand what I'm asking you. Can you answer the question, sir? Will you answer the question? What are you willing to sacrifice? Excuse me?
Yes, sir. I'm willing to
You
sacrifice.
Say, yes, sir? What are you willing to sacrifice? No, no. What are you willing to sacrifice?
Well,
I'm not asking you, are you willing to sacrifice? I mean, that could be anything. What are you willing, to what extent are you willing to sacrifice
well,
in order for this problem to be solved?
Well, I have given my time. I've given up, you know, finances. And if it called, if I could end racism by giving
once
my
again,
life.
Once again, excuse me, sir, excuse me for cutting you off, because I have very short time. And you are telling me your resume. I don't want to hear your resume on what you did. To what extent? The problem is still here, correct? Despite all of those things that you're talking about now, I would like to hear to what extent are you willing to go. I know that's in your brain. I would like for it to come out so all of us can hear it and stop wasting our time.
Well, I certainly don't mean to waste your time. I don't mean to waste your time or energy. I am committed to ending any way that I can, or any of my ability, white supremacy and racism. So whatever that sacrifice would be, whatever that sacrifice would take.
If it would cost you your life, are you willing to still open your mouth and also apply action to solving this problem?
Yes, if it would solve the problem, absolutely my life would be something worth giving.
Okay, what are your experiences when you confront white people, either in collective groups or individually, with this problem?
Again, I know this, but I don't understand what you're asking. When I confront people...
No. I didn't say people. I was specific on what people I'm talking about. White people.
Okay.
Your neighbor.
When I can...
I'm assuming, I could be wrong about this. I'm assuming you stay, you have association, either next door neighbor, maybe a couple of your siblings, male or female, maybe your parents, one of them, both of them are still alive, close relatives, to as close as they can possibly get, if you're married, but white people. Give us some examples of some of the reactions of when bringing your, because you have a lot of understanding. You have a lot of understanding. I would say you have more understanding than most non-white black people of racism. So. But I'm not concerned about how you communicate with us, because white people have been very shrewd as far as the background history, and we have been harmed by that type of relationship. I'm concerned about your relationship with other white people with this information that you have.
Well, I try, whether testifying in court as an expert witness on matters related to this. I just gave a talk to a group. There were some African Americans there, but it was overwhelmingly a white wealthy group, in which I tried to explain racism and why we had to deal with it, particularly in South Carolina.
You said a white wealthy group?
Primarily, it was South Carolina.
I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, there were some, I think they had a lot of powerful people that were there.
What was the overall reaction? What was the overall reaction that as far as feedback that you got back from them?
People were polite.
Did they seem to be on fire about solving the problem?
Some people didn't like it, but I think my goal was to get people to at least think about these things. I really think, you know, as clearly people aren't agreeing with me, but I think a lot of people are just totally unaware. They totally do not believe that racism exists today, that the past has any relationship to the present. And I sent Gus the actual sort of next to the last draft of that speech yesterday.
Who are the unaware white people? You're saying these these quote unquote the people you said you use the word powerful white people, are these the ones who you're saying who are unaware?
No, but there were some. They should be aware, but I actually think people have an amazing ability to fool themselves and to justify what they do and justify themselves and not deal with the historical accuracy. The best I can do as a historian is to do my job as a historian to bring out the truth as best I can get to it and explain it.
We had two other folks who dialed in. I want to make sure I get our other two callers before Professor Burton has to exit. The person that dialed in, appreciate that, retired firefighter. 5640. Did you have a question for Professor Burton?
Yes. Good evening, Gus, and good evening to Professor Burton.
Greetings.
Hi. Professor Burton, do you have African ancestry in your family lineage?
You know, I don't know. I really don't. I had never assumed that I have, but I think we really don't know. But I take it as a in my lineage, you know, back. If I do, I was never told. But I just don't know. I actually believe in my heart of hearts, which sounds naive, that we're all related, that we all come and are all in the image of God and are the same. Doesn't mean that we've been treated the same, unfortunately. That's what we're talking about. But I don't directly know. I had never thought about it until asked tonight, you know.
Okay.
But I don't know my family history very well either.
I'm sorry?
I said, I really don't know my own family history very well. I don't know my own family history very well, very, very far back, except, you know, knew two grandmothers, and so don't know much beyond that.
Okay. I just asked because when I looked at your picture, I thought that you were, like, mixed race or you were part of, like, one of the triracial groups that's common in the mm-hmm. South. I don't know if you've heard of the Maroons and the Lungeons.
Yes,
and I know
ma'am.
A lot of those.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I've actually written about them and things. Fascinating.
Exactly. So I just wanted to offer some advice if you wanted to look into that, because that could be part of your lineage. So just an idea. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you, ma'am. And I don't know. If I find out, I'll let you know. You've made me curious.
Okay, thank you.
For sure.
Thank you.
Last caller, person dialed in from a block number. Did you have a question for Professor Burton?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Professor Burton. I am an African-American victim of racism, white supremacy. My great-great-grandmother was a chattel slave. She was born in 1850. She was freed in 1865 at age 15. And her teenage husband, whom the slave master matched with her as a part of a slave breeding mechanism, mm-hmm. my grandpa Sam, he was freed at age 20. Now, I'm an attorney. I'm having a hard time, you know, getting a job at a major firm, aside from getting these small contractual temporary assignments. You have met with a number of wealthy people. Is there anything you can do with helping me get a job by talking to these people that you say that you know, you say that, you know, you do want to help? I am a victim. I need help. And I also have some law school loans that I think I should not have to pay for because I am a victim. And my great-great-grandmother lived as a slave and lived under Jim Crow. Her children were held down. So we really couldn't advance until fairly recently. And, you know, it took a number of years. And but for the fact that they were slaves, you know, we had to start from scratch several generations later. So if there's something you really say you want to do anything, I am a victim and I need help. I am an attorney. I pulled myself up from my bootstraps, but I still have a lot of student loans, and it is hard getting work. And if you know wealthy people, perhaps you could talk to them on my behalf, and I'll mute my line.
I don't really know a lot of wealthy people. I've worked with, as I said, like NACP and some of these lawyers that work there. They are not very wealthy, you know, ACLU voting and others. But I do believe in reparations. I think that's something the country needs to face. I think it's just one step. It's not the answer, but I really believe in that.
Well, how much out of your pocket are you going to give? Do you have a house? Are you willing to take out a second mortgage and give me $5,000 to pay towards my student loans if I can prove to you who my ancestors were and they were chattel slaves? That would really help me, sir.
Well, and, you know, I wish I could, but I'm afraid that I don't have that kind of money. And I know that's easy enough to say, but it's true.
Thank you, sir. I'll mute my line.
All right.
Right on. I just had a couple quick questions before we let you enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening. The first one, since you are, you know, a Southerner, Professor Burton, I assume that you have heard a racist joke or eight in your life. That's something that I take very seriously and encourage our listeners all the time, not to be offended, but to study those jokes, because they reveal a lot about the white mentality. I would even say white culture, just those racist jokes. Abraham Lincoln, I am told, even shared a racist joke from time to time. Are there any racist jokes that you've heard in your life that you can recall that you could share with us, sir?
I guess I disagree with him. I don't listen to racist jokes. Yes, I heard them growing up and lots of stories and have studied them. I've studied Lincoln's stories, but I feel uncomfortable repeating them. I don't think that racist jokes are something. First of all, there's nothing funny about racism. I think you're right. They can be studied to reveal things, but I would feel uncomfortable. I'm not sure if I could think of any right off, but yeah, I have studied them and I certainly heard them growing up.
Man,
that's part of the culture. It's very uncomfortable, but yeah, and you're right. They're part of the culture.
Joe Feagin, he's been a guest on our program. He's a professor down at Texas A&M, white man, in his book, Two-Faced Racism.
Yeah,
Joe. Oh, right on. He's been with us. We talked about, we spent about 20 minutes talking about racist jokes, because that's a section in his book. And I submit, as a black person in the system of white supremacy, there is no way you can be any more uncomfortable than any victim of white supremacy as a white man, professor at a major university down in South Carolina, just with a racist joke or two. It is immensely helpful to any time we can have white people that have heard these racist jokes and can share some of the ones that they've heard in their life. I would be quite pleased. Are you sure you can't take a moment and think of one and share one or two if you can recall some of the jokes that you've heard in your life?
And I'm so sorry. I really don't. I feel too uncomfortable. I have great respect for Joe Feagin. I'm a great fan of his. I think he does great work. But I feel very uncomfortable with racist jokes. And, you know, it's been years since at least since before I went to college, I told people they started telling a race joke, I would not listen. So, you know, it would go way back, except for having studied them, where they've been analyzed as a scholar or something like that.
That is another pattern we've heard frequently, white people, where I have asked them personally, and I've talked to white people that are like Dylan Storm Roof's age, white teens, white 20-year-olds. I've said, oh, yeah, I've heard tons of these racist jokes, family members, uncles, and that sort of thing, grandparents, brothers, siblings, friends, whatever, and it's the same thing when I'm not upset. I'm not mad. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to curse you and call you names. I would just like to hear, because I think it's an important way of studying, understanding racism, white supremacy, clamming up. Oh, man, I'm not comfortable sharing. That is a pattern that I've observed, which I also find interesting. What exactly do you do in your role in cyber technology at Clemson? What do you do exactly?
Not much anymore. Originally, the Cyber Institute was to foster the sort of research and teaching side in the digital world is what I was originally going to do when I was hired here. It hasn't worked out very well, though.
Fascinating. Fascinating. One of our listeners, last two questions. One of our listeners wanted to know, do you think, since you said that racism, white supremacy is a reality, it exists, it is real, the current power dynamic, white people having more power than non-white people worldwide and in all areas of people activity, that being the case, do you think that your daughter, the one that is married to a black male and has children together, do you think that, that she is practicing racism, being engaged sexually and married to this black male?
No, I don't.
Do you think your white daughter, do you think she has more power than the black male that she's married to?
In a general society, and certainly in their family and their love and their relationship, no, I think it's a very good marriage and a loving marriage, a wonderful family. But, you know, I feel uncomfortable now, Gus, talking about my children and my family.
Well, you brought it up.
I think that's
you brought it up.
I did, and I'm sorry I did, but I was asked, and I answered, and I tried to answer honestly.
Okay. Well, I mean, but you volunteered that information before we even asked about that. You volunteered in saying that you did have African-American grandchildren. And I'm just, you know, asking
somebody.
About,
I think someone asked if there were blacks in my family that I had looked.
No,
black.
You mentioned it at the beginning of the program when I asked if you had any black ancestors, and you volunteered that you had African-American grandchildren. This was before we even got
right.
This was an hour before we got to the caller, so you volunteered this. And I'm just asking about the general power dynamic. If white supremacy does exist, your family and all of that is within the greater context of global white supremacy. So does your daughter, a white woman, does she have more power than the black male she's married to?
Well, if you accept your definition of white supremacy and that dynamic in the United States, in the world, then I think we would have to say all whites do. But in terms of the reality,
I want to make sure this is your view. This is not taking my perspective. I'm asking your thoughts. What do you think?
No. No, I don't.
Okay.
He's...
Were you going to say something else? You said he's...
No, that's all right.
Okay. Are you still a professor at Clemson? Like, this is not an emeritus thing? You're not retired?
Right. I'm retired from the University of Illinois.
Okay.
I'm emeritus at the University of Illinois.
Okay. I have a compensatory investment request. I would like to request, if it's possible... I do research. I enjoy reading. Read your book, the material, the other scholarly material that you went, that you mailed to me, thankfully. Stephen Kantrowitz, his book on Ben Tillman. It would be great if I could get access to the Clemson Library online just to be able to go through and read material, do more study on Ben Tillman, look at some of the scholarly articles that they have. Do you think it's possible? Is that something that you could do to see if I could get access to just be able to go online and check out some of the library materials at the Clemson Library?
I don't think I can do that. I know that my children have asked the same thing, and I can't get them, access to it.
Well, that would be something if you could look into at least. That I would definitely appreciate it. We've been here for.
I do think there are some. Actually, there's a new. National Digital Library that probably has more that everybody is welcome to now than that's national. I have to get that. The Clemson is not a great library. It doesn't have a lot. But I know that my children have wanted to try to use it, and I couldn't get permission for them to. It's only students or faculty, you know. Sometimes they don't even let emeriti use it.
Well, if you could check both, really, the one that you don't have to be a Clemson student, the national one, if you could get me the address or what have you, that would be great. And if you could at least ask, if they say no, no worries. I don't have my hopes up. But that would at least be something I'd like to ask. I want to see if I can.
Okay, I promise I will ask.
Outstanding. We will.
I really think all library and all knowledge should be available to everybody. I really do. That's one of my griefs about our education system.
I I agree with you 1,000% there. I think that's one of the ways, in my view, that racists, they hide a lot of information so that we would have a much better, much clearer understanding of white supremacy if we had access to more of the information that they have stored up in institutions like Clemson and what have you. It has been a hoot discussing with you this evening, Professor Burton. Glad we could have you on the program. Appreciate you sharing a bit of your time. Folks, if you are interested, you can look online at his site at Clemson University, his faculty page, and you'll see the book that we talked about this evening, as well as some of his other scholarship. We will definitely keep an eye on the situation down in Clemson as it unfolds, and we'll look forward to speaking to you down the road, Professor Burton.
I just got information, Gus, that they went in and arrested some of the students who are sitting in.
Oh, wow.
I just got a text. Yeah, so here's what, let me just tell you this, and then I will get off. And five of our students, now known as the Clemson Five, were arrested after refusing to leave Sykes Hall when it closed at 5:30. The short button, then it goes on to talk about them, their subject. So
they were protesting the banana situation? That's what they were protesting?
Yeah, that's much. Well, they, yes, and using that to say we won't, in solidarity with others, and we want to have changes made. Mm. So that was it.
Wow.
Okay, well, I'll keep you posted, okay?
Please do. Please do.
Okay. All right.
Evening, Professor Burton. Yes, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
Context of White Supremacy, Professor Vernon Burton, visiting with us live down in South Carolina. We put together a whole little page of the people that we've had on the program over the past year and some change who have visited with us from South Carolina, some of the different topics that we have discussed. South Carolina is going to pop up again next week when we start medical apartheid. Harriet Washington, she spends a good chunk of time talking about J. Marion Sims, another South Carolina icon. He's got statues in South Carolina and Alabama and New York for mutilating black females, enslaved black females in the 19th century. But she talks quite a bit about Mr. Sims and his legacy, modern day legacy, continuing even. I think he has his statue in New York, I believe, is in Central Park, unless I'm mistaken. Anywho, we will make time if folks have anything that they would like to share based on what they heard this evening, any closing comments or what have you before we get ready to wrap things up. I can only again emphasize, well, I guess number one, before I even get to that.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Lots of buckets, lots of buckets. The pattern with those racist jokes, very, very common. I think Karen Brandon is one of the few exceptions. And she actually is the one that mentioned Mr. Burton's work. If folks remember, she was on last month, the white woman. She was talking about her family that participated in lynching, killing four black people in Georgia. This is in the 1900s. But she mentioned Professor Burton's work. She's one of the few whites that we've had on the program when asked directly about racist jokes who was willing to share and could come up and think of a few. I've seen this pattern in person and when we've had people on the phone where it's like, uh-oh, I'm not going to tell you niggers any of the jokes that I've heard. I'm uncomfortable and I'm about to break out in tears right now just thinking about it, which is extremely suspicious to me. And I've seen, as I said, I've seen this pattern for years. When you get to the point where you are not fuming, where you're not the one stomping up and down, when they call you nigger or a spear chucker or anything, whatever they say, you're not upset. I'm content. I'm calm. My heart rate has not increased at all. I'm chilling. I just want to hear the joke so I can write it down. What do you say? Uh-huh, niggers, and mm-hmm, driving slow so he looks like he's going to a nigger funeral, mm-hmm, okay, and just write it down. I'm not mad, I'm not cursing, I'm not calling you in it. It's whites. I've seen that consistently. They are the ones that get uncomfortable, or at least they're ready to clam up, like, uh-oh, this nigger is not doing the typical thing, I'm going to hush now, stop talking, because I'm not accustomed to black people that are not being emotional and just charged and ready to fight. I know how to deal with all that. When they're just calm and studying us, oh, man, we're not supposed to be aiding in them getting a better understanding of whites. I just am not going to say anything. That's what I've seen. That's my interpretation of what's happening in that event. I also thought it was telling when he backtracked about talking about the dynamics of his daughter being married to a black male to go to the defense that I'm uncomfortable talking about my family and what have you, and you all brought it up. Not true at all. Why it's always great if you can really be attentive and have your mental faculties operating at a high level to keep track of the conversation, what's been said, even if you can keep track of the precise terms that are being used, because he's the one that volunteered that information. I've seen that as well, where whites strategically, they will volunteer information and bring up things about themselves personally if they think that, hey, it'll get these niggers if I tell them I have black grandchildren. They will think that I'm not racist and not be suspicious. If that doesn't work, and that's something where, oh, they want to interrogate and investigate, oh, wait a minute, you're talking about my family. I'm not comfortable talking about my family. This is, you know, private matter. We'll talk about, you know, our book. We talk about Donald Trump or what have you, but I'm not comfortable. And he was the one that volunteered that at first. I didn't ask him anything about his grandchildren or children or anything of that nature. I just asked him if he had any, to his knowledge, any black people in his ancestry at the beginning of the program. And he brought that up of his own volition. I thought that was interesting and tacky as well. Another act of racism, white supremacy. There were many throughout the course of the program. The only thing I can say consistently, that insistence that whites are ignorant, that they're not well informed, that is hogwash. I mean, Professor Burton is a great example himself. I think there were so many times some of the listeners pointed out where I don't understand the question that you're asking. I don't speak English that well. I almost felt like it was that the mythology of the dumb white person. I'm just a bumbling dumb white person. I don't quite understand what's being said. I don't quite understand what you're asking of me. This guy is a professor, has been a professor at the University of Illinois, professor at Clemson University. These are flagship institutions. This is not some rinky-dink community college off, you know, in the hills or what have you. These are like the flagship institutions of these respective states, Illinois and South Carolina. Expert testimony. I think he said he was a distinguished scholar at the University of Illinois, and that stuck out to me because we had Bill Ayers on the program back in 2009. He also was a distinguished scholar at the University of Illinois. Bill Ayers, in addition to being credited as being a mentor to President Obama, he was in Students for Democratic Society, that organization. They participated in going out and bombing federal buildings and saying, you know, down with the man, down with the system. We're against racism, rah, 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 doing all that. And then he becomes a distinguished professor at University of Illinois, writing books and all this, saying that he's against racism, where white people, they are experts, and brag about their expertise under any other circumstances, any other context. We are the smartest people in the universe. You niggers don't hold a candle to us in terms of intellectual acumen. It's no way. That's why we dominate you any other time. But once I understand that, and matter of fact, I'm coming to you as an expert. Oh, wait a minute. I'm not an expert. I'm ignorant. You niggers, y'all know way more about this than I do. Published books. He's a Pulitzer Prize nominated author and claiming ignorance. I don't know. You're more knowledgeable about that than me, Gus. I've seen that pattern consistently, and that is nonsense. And I think part of that, it is designed to play on the psychology of victims of racism. Excuse me. I have a cough drop. I'm not feeling well, and I choked on my cough drop. Thank goodness I did not get choked out on air. But it's, in my view, it's designed to play on our psychology. We've been so beaten down and so accustomed to the bell curve and black people insisting that, you know, you niggers, your brain is about the size of a pecan. You're the most ignorant, retarded, ignorant folks in the history of life. And you and your grandparents and your grandparents and your children, all of you. And we need to have some ignorant little Mickey Mouse law school for you. Isn't that what Justice Scalia said at the end of last year, weeks before his death? From the Supreme Court bench, no less. Isn't that what he said? Black people don't perform very well at these top flight institutions. He was talking about the University of Texas at the time. But they've said this for years. That's been their ideology. That's been racist think. But once you start talking about racism, white supremacy with suspicion, it's white people who are dumb, white people who are poorly informed. That's nonsense. You can't even say that with Dylan Storm Roof, that he was ignorant. He took pictures that came out, I think, some months after his terrorist act, that he had visited all these historical sites and was taking photographs and next to these monuments and what have you of all these figures in white culture, the lore of South Carolina, and books that he had written about it. This guy was not ignorant at 21 years of age. Maybe he didn't have a PhD or what have you, but clearly he was not ignorant about what he was doing. And I submit that that is the case with whites in mass. They're not ignorant. They're not stupid. The problem is not that white people are poorly informed. I just again quote from Professor Burton's book when he said that all white children learned about racism. That's exactly what he said in the book, and you had better believe it. It's true 2016. It's true for the duration of racism, white supremacy. They cannot, are not ignorant. If anyone is ignorant about racism, it's us, Gus T. Renegade, at the top of the list. That's it. We'll hit some of the folks who dialed in. I also thought it was pretty interesting, his response to the question. You can go back and check it out when I asked him if he thought what he wrote in his own book about religion being used as a means to control and groom black people to be easier to control and dominate, if that had any impact or correlation to what transpired with the victims of racism in the courtroom last year, the victims of the Mother Emanuel massacre, when they said, you know, we forgive, and this is our religious doctrine encourages us to forgive and not be here in the spirit of vengeance or spitefulness. I know Dr. Welsing talked about that extensively on the program last year, but I thought that was fascinating as well, the retort that he gave in saying, no, he didn't think that that was the case and that that changed white people and all the other malarkey, buckets and buckets of words. But that was an interesting exchange as well. Anywho, we'll get to the folks who dialed in. I'll check, see if it's anybody. I think all these people, I think, unless I'm incorrect, I think everybody that's with us now was able to get a question. So there shouldn't, you know, just anybody that, if you are on the line, if you have any comments or observations about you, what you heard from Professor Burton, you should be with us. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you.
Go ahead, Ross.
All right. Thanks, Thomas. Wow. I think tonight goes down in history. The caller from Alabama, oh, I love him. I love what he did. I just love his questions. He stayed so sharp and on point. Firefighter in Florida, my hero, got it in really well tonight too. And the sister that is in law school. It was just an ode to Neely Fuller Jr. As far as just compensatory requests. I thought that was awesome and brilliant, and it also just showed his lack of really wanting to do anything serious about racism, white supremacy. I found it very, very telling, even what you brought up just now in regards to him speaking about religion. I just thought of that immediately. I thought Yorugu, I thought rhetorical ethics, and I thought he was just using buckets and buckets of words to try and excuse white behavior both in the past and today, as far as just the way he voiced his opinion on that specific question regarding religion and the fact that those black people literally within 24 hours of their relatives getting murdered are talking about they forgive the Dylan Storm Roof. I also found it interesting how he doubled back when I brought up the fact that he talked about us in today living in the remnants of racism, white supremacy, and that it wasn't the same. And he literally, like, he basically lied because he went right back and said that that's not what he said when that's exactly what he said. I wrote it down right after he said it, and the word remnant stood out because I'm like, how could this be a remnant of white supremacy when we have no control over any of the 10 areas of people activity, none, and that's why I named them, so that he could understand, like, we're in the same position now that we were then, minus the shackles, but you're sitting here saying that we're living in the remnants of white supremacy. I just thought he was highly refined. I thought he really tried to use his credentials as an advocate for Mr. Woodfox and the other black people who he spoke in defense of in court as a means of bolstering what he thought would have been us treating him as one of those, hey, you know, all we need is another 10,000 of Mr. Burton and we'll get this problem solved, you know, the way that you put it normally. I just found him extremely refined. I love the question about his daughter because, again, he agreed with the fact that the system exists. He agreed, again, that the sexual dynamic was rape. And basically his daughter's raping that black male, and he did not want to say that, I'm assuming. He probably didn't want to answer to his daughter and his son-in-law and possibly his grandchildren, depending on their age, based on the fact that he literally agreed and then just went back on everything he said when it came to his daughter. All of a sudden, everything was magically different. And then also what you pulled out, too, the fact that he volunteered that he had African-American grandchildren. No one pulled that out of him. He volunteered that. You are absolutely correct. And I just think he's a highly refined white supremacist. And also, to be a person, like you said, a distinguished scholar at Illinois University and Clemson and all of this stuff, he seemed to not know much of anything when he was asked asked questions that he found were uncomfortable for him to deal with. And I believe his discomfort has to do with him addressing his own internal racism, white supremacy. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line there.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good evening to all. Yeah, I have to second in on what Roz just said. Me and Roz was texting during the show, and man, firefighter, caller from Alabama, the lady who asked for, like, can you find me a job? Can you send me some money to my loans? That was excellent. Man, Brother Polite, he was on a show, and he said that he gets reparations every month from 10 white people. I don't know how he does it, but he said the money's in his account every month. I would love to know. Need to call him on Gus to ask him that one. But man, that was an awesome show. I was kicking myself because I read the Hulk Hogan tweets today. His from the sex tape, the audio where he was talking about niggers and his daughter, you know, possibly in a sexual relationship with one of the black rappers that was trying to help out with her career, and how at least he's a rich nigga, you know. And, you know, that's why I kind of kicking myself for not asking that question of what his daughter was a racist. I'm glad you asked that, Gus. And he was practicing racism, in my opinion, because I had did a lot of research on when I found out, you know, looked the guy up and saw he came from 96, South Carolina. I said, they named the city 96. So I pulled out my encyclopedias, and I said, I got to find the city. And I found it, and the history of that city, quite extensive, set up and founded for Sephardic Jews, which is another way of saying in the 1600s, that's another way of saying black people from Europe, and they had their own courts, their own jails. They didn't deal with the United States or whatever government was set up in the state of California at that time, and until the Revolutionary War, where they went and fought and helped the white people and ended up losing their freedom as a subsequent to that. So I was just had a bunch of questions, but it's funny how a historian from 96 doesn't know nothing about his own city. That I find that to be extremely, extremely a practice of racism, because the whole foundation of his city is based on racism. He's just to admit that these black people were free black people at that time. But I won't go into that. Thank you very much for the show. This was a classic show.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, what this show does for me as far as helping me as a victim of racist white supremacy, first from your, Gus, your understanding of racist white supremacy to whereas you hold as a high priority in putting white people, and not just any white person, but white people who has all of these long credentials, and most of the time they actually brag about it. They brag about it, and they have all these credentials because what it does for non-white black people who are victims of racism, white supremacy, give them a confidence level, and it also boosts up our ratings as how we become less confused on the system of racial white supremacy and be able to, in a calm manner, be able to articulate, question a white person at any time, in any place. And I feel myself getting sharper and sharper at that particular maneuver. And when I was questioning, because when I was questioning him, I mean, it's only so many reasons why, under a system of racism and white supremacy, that a white person would have that interest. Any interest of wanting to have a large understanding of racism, you know, from a standpoint of to articulate it to other people. Otherwise, they don't have to have any attention to it. So that the crap on, you know, on talking to us. You know, what are you doing? What are you willing to sacrifice? That, you know, like I said, my question: what are you willing to sacrifice? You know, from what you're doing, because you will be having to give up something if you're going to be around a lot of white people. And he had the nerve to even mention that he'd been in the presence of quote unquote, and he said powerful white people. And he gave the correct answer. You know, basically what he was saying was they didn't pay no attention to him, as far as they're concerned. You know, I mean, he didn't really get real deep into what was the reaction, but basically that's what I got out of it. You know, like, what the hell? I mean, yeah, okay, next, you know, as far as they're concerned, on the reaction that they gave to him, as far as they're concerned. Which is something for any non-white black person to be able to view and understand as a reality. This is their behavior on a 24/7 basis, and you just can't take these people serious. You can't take them serious at all. Those who I appreciate more of the ones who, like Malcolm X said, is the wolf who lets you know that meat is on my diet. Well, I shouldn't say that. So that's a metaphor, but anyway, that openly tells you, you know, that I'm a racist, I hate your guts, and if my objective is to keep you in a subservient position, you know, that's more of an appreciation instead of, you know, people like this. But it's a good case study, very great case study. Thank you.
For sure. Any of the other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, y'all have any comments you wanted to make sure you got in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I thought it was interesting when you talked about white people that don't like to admit that they, you know about the N-word and all that, because I was watching one of the black judge shows today, and it was this white woman was suing this other white female about money owed from a sorority. She had been kicked out of a sorority, and the head house mother was telling the black judge that the girl had been kicked out because she used the N-word. And the judge said, "What's the N-word? You mean never?" And she said, "No, she used the derogatory N-word to refer to African Americans." And the judge said, "Oh, that doesn't even bother me anymore." And she asked the white girl, she said, "Why do you use that?" She said, "Well, I listen to rap and I love Drake and he uses it all the time, and me and my friends, we always say it. We say it referring to other white people too. It doesn't mean anything." And the judge was saying, "I don't even care about that word anymore. It doesn't even bother me." And I was wondering, I'm like, I wonder if they told her to say that, or if she really feels like that, because I know it shouldn't bother me, but I'm a child of the civil rights movement. I mean, I'm a child of the civil rights era, and it still bothers me bad. I mean, it shouldn't, but it does. And like I said on a much earlier show, my kids were verbally attacked when they were small by two grown racists that was threatening to attack them and was calling them that and stuff. So, you know, it's just kind of hard for me as a black person to not get upset or get mad when a black person, you know, says, "That word doesn't even bother me." I guess this judge, which she's brown skinned and she wears a blonde wig, and she, she looks to be, it does bother me. And there was a time a few months ago, me and my son was going to get our taxes done,
and there was these three teenage females, and they were walking past us, and they were laughing. They kept saying, "Igga, igga, 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 igga," and they kept looking at us and stuff. And my son, you know, he looked like, you know, he just blew it off. I mean, I know it bothered him, but he's smart that I, you know, because I told him, I said, just pretend like it doesn't bother you. But it's hard, even though I tell them that, it's hard for me to pretend like it doesn't bother me, you know. And I guess maybe it's the generation I was, you know, I grew up in, you know, or what, you know, I'm not sure. But that's all I want to say. Thanks.
I definitely understand. It's, I mean, even if you, given the information about the generation when you were born, even if it was someone that was born in 2000 or in the 90s, thinking about the children that were at the university, I believe it was the University of Texas, A&M, I think. I might be incorrect, but I think it was A&M, where they were on the tour. They were like 16 or 17. They were on the tour, and someone came up and called them niggers while they were on the tour, and something, I think Confederate flag and all that stuff. And they said that they were bothered about what happened. I think that's logical. I don't think it's anything. To me, it makes total sense. I think it's just, at least my perspective, I think in codification and just getting a better understanding of the environment that we're in, even when white people are not directly calling us niggers and spear chuckers or whatever else, the racist jokes and other names that they have for us, probably more to come, the offense is still there. I mean, everything about how this world operates under white supremacy is an offense, is something, is contempt. Everything about how all areas of people activity operate is in contempt, with total contempt, total disregard for black people, black life, past, present, future. So I think when, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, when I got a better understanding of that and not being surprised when these sort of things happen, I think you can get to that point. And I think most importantly, primarily, exactly like what happened today and many other times on the program, when white people do that and you don't respond, you don't get upset, you don't get emotional, and just seeing how they respond, how they end up being the ones that look uncomfortable, like they're trying to figure out what to do, what to say. That, more than anything else, just for me, reinforced, man, it's so important to get to that point where you can be disciplined, where it's not something that bothers you, where you don't feel angry or upset or what have you, when white people do that sort of thing. They are just revealing their nature. I think, as you know, retired fighter said before, I would much rather have that so that I can take it as a reminder. Yes, we're in a system of white supremacy. I have enemies. An enemy just announced himself to me. That's good information for me to know. Make sure I'm on my P's and Q's. Make sure that I'm not relaxed, thinking that this is my pal, somebody we can go have a coffee with or what have you. I can keep an eye on you. If you're in an employment situation, that's great. Great information. I can know this person is in an employment situation and they're going around calling black people niggers. It's just so that I can be better informed about the environment that I'm in and not lie to myself first and foremost about where we are, what it means to be white. That's the way that I take it, because the offense is there. Like I said, even if that white person is coming up and all giggles, grins, let me give you a hug, even, hey, here's a job application. Hey, let me help you get this job, or let me help you get, even then, they still think of me as a nigger. That's what it means to be white. That's what this system is. So I would much rather just have the honesty about the world that we live in and the people, the whites that I am around, so I can function correctly, logically. But I definitely understand the logic of, you know, why you would feel that way. Anybody, why they would feel that way.
Well, you know, it's funny, man. I was called a nigger today by a white lady. And the same white lady called me a nigger in the same place 5 years ago. I started a job this week, and I'm working in the same area I worked in 5 years ago, and it's a lady who stands outside on 45th Street between 6th and 5th Avenue in Manhattan, and she hands out flyers for men to go upstairs and, you know, get these suits, you know. So, you know, they have a little trick where they make the card make noise and they try to hand it to you. And I never take things from people in the street like that. So I walked past her 5 years ago. She called me a nigger. And this time, I had to stop and laugh. So I went over and said, well, what do you mean by that? Why would you call me a nigger? And she was like, so stunned. Like, I wasn't mad. I folded my arms. I had a smile. I was so happy she called me a nigga. So I was like, hey, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, and she was like, you know, just leave me alone. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I stood there for a second. I just walked off because, I mean, it don't bother me. But for a judge to say that to me, I mean, people can lose their jobs behind calling. They can get transferred for calling someone a nigger. I mean, today, I mean, you can't tweet it. I mean, you got kids spelling out nigger on their feet, on their shirts. And, I mean, it becomes a huge thing where they could possibly lose their scholarships, which I doubt. But I'm just saying, I mean, how could a judge who is supposed to be making judgment calls on some things where someone is probably calling, that's a hate crime or hate speech. But, you know, but it's just funny that she brought that up because I was called a nigger today.
That's the pattern that I've seen. When you don't respond to them, when you don't get angry, when you don't have your, again, I can reference the site, when you don't chimp out, it's the white people that get upset. I've seen that, and I've seen that with other people too. I think other people have called in over the years and shared on the program when white people have done that sort of thing, racist joke. Even one of our listeners, they were out, I think, at a bowling alley, no less, since that was brought up with the Hamburg massacre, and a white person, they were in the middle of the racist joke, but they were close enough that this non-white person heard it. And so they just started listening like, oh, what's the joke? Let me hear. And the whites were like, what? No offense. You know, just telling a little joke. And they said, hey, I'm not upset. I just wanted to hear the joke. I'm not angry. This tell a joke. And they were like, I don't know. Okay. And they went ahead and gave the racist joke. I forget, it's been some years, so I forgot what it was. But I have seen this consistently. That is the typical type of reaction that you will get. It really just a matter of getting discipline. And again, this is what it means to be white. You're just giving me a reminder. I appreciate that. This is who we're dealing with. This is the enemy. This is the problem.
I was going to say, I think when white people see a black person, especially, but any non-white person who does not react to racist speech, it's almost like when a computer gets information that it just cannot register properly, and it kind of, it's like, I can't compute. It's like they feel that they have us pegged so well that the word nigga is just going to, you know, set us off on a fiery path of rage, that when we don't react that way and it's more of a relaxed, like you said, zen, almost a scientific approach and a methodical approach and a logical approach. Normally that's the approach they take to white supremacy. So when they see it in the reverse, I think it's shocking to them. And for the sister who was speaking about how she felt, it's interesting because my son was born in 1995 and he could not, to this day, he cannot stand the word nigga at all. And when black people use it around him, matter of fact, all the black people in his company know not to use it in his presence. He does not tolerate it from anyone. So I'm more or less grooming him now to become more refined, like what Gus is discussing, get to the point where it does not offend you like that. Because I was a young guy when I was growing up in the crack era. I used to assault white people. Like, so for anybody to call me out my name, it was an assault. And for me to go from that, like a person who would get physically violent with folks, to someone who could just, you know, like the story that Gus just said, if somebody called me a nigga, or even Thomas said, somebody called me a nigga, I would have to jump right in the question lane. Whereas I know years ago, I was a really not a safe person to be around if I was offended by anyone. Respect for me was very high on my totem pole, and I would basically take it if I felt I had to take it. So for me to go from that to this is a real growth for me. And it doesn't mean that you haven't grown, because the word itself is meant to offend. Like us were saying, it's meant to be a destructive thing. So it's totally understandable. But if you can get to that place where it does not have that sort of visceral effect on you, and especially when you're in the presence of white people, you'll start to see exactly what Gus said and what Thomas talked about. They cannot understand it, and it's almost like they don't know how to handle you at all. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Always one of my favorites, ode to Mr. Fuller, where he says, what do you do with a nigger? And see what they say. They say that. He said that always generates a pretty solid response, seeing how whites respond to that. Let's just get to the bottom line. I'm a nigger. What should be done with, for, about me? And wait for a response. Anything else? Folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap up. We should be here tomorrow. Final session, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World. It has been a hoot reading her work as well. We'll wrap that up tomorrow. Compensatory call-in is on Saturday, normal time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. The Global Sunday Talk on Racism, this Sunday, early time, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And we should be here Monday as well. That's when we should have the program, I believe. I'm just waiting to make sure we get confirmation for attempted counter-racist parents, some of the folks who are listening in to talk about how racism, getting a better understanding of racism, has kind of altered the way that they parent, the way that the relationship that they have with their offspring, in comparison, contrast, kind of how things were before they understood racism a little bit better, and then how things are now. That should be Monday. So we should be here the next, I guess that's next 4 days. We'll be here every day. Stay tuned if you have questions, problems, gripes. Drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Folks have anything else they want to get in, Professor Burton, or anything else from this evening's broadcast? Everyone satisfied? I was surprised nobody got a question in to relate Donald Trump to Ben Tillman, but there was... not a whole lot of honesty, in my view, from Professor Burton. So I can't say I'm surprised, because that was certainly something that I had kind of relating the two figures, Ben Tillman and Donald Trump, particularly the violence that has been associated with Donald Trump's campaign over the past few months or so. But I'm sure we'll have time to dissect and add to that down the road.
I didn't ask that because I figured I'm pretty much convinced that he's following the Ben Tillman playbook. I mean, a white person can't convince me of it, you know. I mean, I think the last white person kind of hinted, yeah, you know, I think the same person said that Hillary was a racist too. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, I didn't really think it was pertinent. Because, I mean, you know, when I'm talking to a historian and they're not historically accurate, or to me that's just like, you know, you're a historian. How don't you know about your own place you live, you know? I didn't think that it was, I think that he would have just been practicing racism if he was asked that question.
Yep. I concur. I think he even said that Strom Thurmond is, they have a institute, a part of the campus at Clemson University is named after Strom Thurmond, which again, just for me, further reinforces why I'm no fan of taking the flag down. I know he spent a lot of time diverting and the buckets of words around the flag as though that was something constructive, them moving to take the flag down. And I've written about that, talked about that. I thought that was all nonsense, racist refinement to act as though this is whites have changed, when you are drowning in symbolism, representation of racism, white supremacy. That's the whole campus of Clemson University. That's the whole world that we live in. You're going to take down this one symbol of racism, and you're leaving up like 8 billion others. I think as call in Florida said, are we going to change? Are we no longer going to call the city Jacksonville? Are we no longer going to have that? Are we no longer going to have Francis Scott Key, the national anthem, penned by a racist white supremacist? They had to take some of the racist lyrics out of the national anthem as it was originally penned by Francis Scott Keys. I mean, what are you talking about? Like, just leave all that stuff up. Just make sure everybody is real clear about who these folks are. Strom Thurmond, rapist, racist. That's who this institute is named after.
When you asked him, can he hook you up with some library that he was practicing racism there? Because if he already knew that his kids asked and they couldn't do it, he just would have said, no, I can't do it. But, hell, I don't think so. No, but, you know, my kids had asked once and, you know, they couldn't do it. So I doubt I could do it for you. You know, just like, just practicing racism.
I agree. I'm going to ask that question to all the folks that we get in that are professors, particularly if they're like tenured, a little bit higher up, have a little bit more power at their institution, to ask them that, because that would be, I mean, it's massive, the amount of resources that they have at a lot of these institutions where you can just go online and through their catalogs. I mean, a lot of times you can get access to new books that are out that are just published, like within the last few weeks and what have you. Archives, you can go back in archives for newspaper magazines all across the country. Go back and see what was published in the New York Times 100 years ago. I mean, it is incredible the amount of information that they have stored at these institutions. Access, one of the ways that white people deny us access to information. Anything else? Folks satisfied? Can wrap up?
And he said they don't have a good library at Clemson. I'm thinking Clemson, like, this is a major 25,000-30,000 student institution. They have an extensive, I mean, better than the local college, I'm sure, in anyone's neighborhood. I mean, this is a huge university. I mean, on the same par as a Notre Dame or, I mean, you know, it's not Ivy League, but it's huge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's better than your community college. As I said, that Clemson flagship university, they were just in the national championship game. You get millions of dollars just for that alone, that sort of thing. And they've had a big football program for a number of years. They're in the ACC major conference. That is hogwash, in my opinion. If you've been to any of these major state institutions, even the worst library there tends to be pretty good. It tends to be a lot better than your local public libraries in most instances. Not all, but in most instances, it tends to be pretty good in terms of the amount of information and resources that they will have. And getting better from what I've seen with all the technology online and everything, getting better as they scan more documents and information and literature and different things from 19th century, as they get all that stuff scanned and digitized and get it archived and what have you. It's getting better with the passing hour getting better. Anything else? Last comment before we wrap up? Folks are satisfied? Hoorah. Great questions. Appreciate everyone, all the folks who were able to call in to ask questions this evening. Outstanding. Always great to improve our skills. Questioning racists, whites. Phenomenal. Hopefully we can all do a better job moving forward, getting even better, asking questions, and even listening. I think that came up today, and it can be difficult. I think that's another part of the strategy, using buckets and buckets of words so that you kind of are not as attentive, not as focused to what they're saying, or not able to remember what they said. If the question was even answered, typical type of strategy that they will employ, just something to keep in mind when you're talking to whites. But again, we'll be back about 24 hours. The Anita McLean final session. Looking forward to that tomorrow. If you have problems, questions, gripes, suggestions, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, you'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner of the page. If you're not in a PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested in us 7+ years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. With that, as I say consistently, I saw today someone posted on my page, Monsanto, they have come up with some GMO cannabis, which I'm not surprised about. I wouldn't even be surprised that they had had that for 20 years, 40 years, 50 years, who knows. But they, matter of fact, they had that. Someone posted that on my blog today. I posted earlier in the week, they had another article, and this was at NPR. This was not some rinky-dink site or Alex Jones, some conspiracy theorist site. This was on NPR, that they had a report talking about how LSD is great and puts you in touch with the universe. We just talked about that with John Patasha. I was like, man, that was such great timing when we had him on the program. But that, and then today, as I said, we had one of our listeners. She posted about Monsanto and their genetically modified cannabis. That's what's going to be coming down the road with all of this legalization. Cannabis for all, crack for all, heroin for all, LSD for all. That's about what I said was going to happen. They'll probably have little dispensaries where you can get all this stuff, same place, same time, side by side. You can have all this stuff piled up. Dr. Welsing had commented about this as well. Who knows what sort of chemicals and other sort of scientific deviance has gone on before this gets to you, for you to have your good time lighting up or however else you consume for the weekend. Just keep that in mind, and why I insist sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You want to be clear, lucid, so we can make the best possible decisions, have our brain computer functioning at maximum efficiency to deal with and permanently neutralize whites. Certainly, if you're going to be out and about, driver, passenger, pedestrian, you do not want to be intoxicated. You are making the job of Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldier, you are making their job super easy. You do not want to be in that position where you're not in your right mind when those blinking lights are behind you and your life or anybody else that might be in the vehicle with you is dependent on you making the best possible decision, and you're a little bit inebriated. Man, terrible day, terrible decision. Sobriety would be best. Buckle up as well. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with enforcement officers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.